Coming up next on Twitch, This Week in Tech, I'm Jason Howell, filling in for Leo Laporte, who will return next week. So it's just one last time without Leo at the helm. We've got what actually is a pretty cool CNET reunion of sorts. Tim Stevens, Rich DeMuro, Abrar Alhiti, and I should mention Benito behind the board, also from CNET. We've got a lot of really cool stuff to talk about. ChatGPT's one-year birthday, and my, have we come so far in a single year when it comes to generative AI. Apple's name drop feature and why it's not quite as controversial as people online seem to be making it out to be. Black Friday, Cyber Monday, record sales. Where's the recession that everybody has been talking about? Tim Stevens breaks apart pinball machines and it kind of gives me a little bit of a panic attack. And Kiss says farewell by saying hello to virtual avatars. That and so much more coming up next on This Week in Tech.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 956, recorded Sunday, December 3rd, 2023. A giant rolling brick. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Good news! If you're hiring, you've got help. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter works for you to find great candidates fast. Its smart technology identifies qualified candidates for you, and you can invite your top choices to apply. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by Stamps.com. Get your business ready for the holiday rush. Sign up with promo code TWIT for a special offer that includes a four-week trial, free postage, and a free digital scale. Just go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone at the top of the page and enter code TWIT. And by ExpressVPN. Protect your data and identity every time you go online with the number one rated VPN provider. Get their special holiday offer right now, and you can get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN for free with a one-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twit to learn more. And by Lookout. Whether on a device or in the cloud, your business data is always on the move. Minimize risk, increase visibility, and ensure compliance with Lookout's unified platform. Visit lookout.com today. It's time for Twit, This Week in Tech, and just one more week without Leo. I promise he returns this next week. In fact, I think he's already done with his week of no technology. But he's not back here. That's why you get me, Jason Howell, sitting in for Leo. I don't get the opportunity to sit in on This Week in Tech very often, so I am very much looking forward to today's episode. Thank you for welcoming me into your podcast this week. Anyways, I am joined by a pretty awesome cast. And when I started booking this episode, it became clear what I needed to do pretty quickly because everybody that's on this show either works or has worked at CNET, including myself. I was there 5 years. And so was Tim Stevens, who is no longer with CNET now, of course, been gone from CNET for quite a while, but timstevens.substack.com. How you doing, Tim?
I'm doing great, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. I'm so happy to have you on here, the nicest guy in tech. Do you ever get sick of hearing that? Because I know that's followed you around since, what, was it a Forbes article or something like that?
I think it was Fortune, actually, quite a long ago. So, no, I feel very fortunate, actually, not to be too punny there. But no, it was a great honor, actually, to be told that. And I'm very happy that that's continued. I hope to live up to that. I try to. Anyway.
You always do. You're one of my favorites. I appreciate you being here, Tim. Thanks, it's really great to have you. Also joining me is Abrar Alhiti, who actually works for CNET right now as a video host and producer and just all around awesome person. Abrar, it's really great to have you here today. Thank you.
So great to be here. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on with Tim and to talk to Rich for the first time and to be on with you as well.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, we, Micah Sargent and I have been doing Tech News Weekly for years and we started inviting you onto that show. And every time we invited you on, after the show, Micah and I would have our conversations about post show and be like, man, I love Abrar. She is awesome. Oh, and so, you know, we started to kind of figure out how we can get you more integrated. And so I love seeing that you're on This Week in Tech. So it's great to have you part of this family too.
So I'm very touched by that, and I love you both so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And of course, you did allude to our final guest, which is Rich DeMuro. It's so great to see you, Rich. It's been a while.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jason. Good to see you as well.
That's right. Tech reporter at KTLA Morning News, host of Rich on Tech Radio Show. Now, Rich on Tech Radio Show, once upon a time, that was Leo's radio show, right?
Yeah.
And that now has the new name and everything. How's that going
for you?
That was
the tech guy. And, that's right. It's been going great. It's been almost a year, which I cannot believe. But the listeners have been great. You know, a lot of them have welcomed me with open arms. I get a lot of comparisons to Leo every single week. So
he did the show for a very long time. Yeah.
Yes, he did it for a very long time. So I understand that. But it's been a lot of fun. And honestly, I never did radio before. And it is incredibly fun. It really, truly is. Very different from TV.
Oh, for sure. For sure. It's got to also be a challenge knowing that every time you sit down to do that show, you are going to get a host of questions. At least I'm assuming you're going to get a host of questions about technology that you don't necessarily have a lot of insight into what those questions are prior to doing the show, right? Because it's all done live in real time.
Yeah. I mean, it's live callers. And honestly, doing the show has been so much fun because if I get stumped on something, I am so excited to try to like go home and figure it out. I'm like, now I need to know exactly how this is done or why this is happening to people. And so it's kind of like expanded, my tech knowledge because I'm just hearing stuff that like I wouldn't typically think about. I'm like, never thought about that kind of problem.
Yeah, I could see the thinking about putting myself in that situation would be uncomfortable. It's like, what about all the things that I don't know? Like, I would hate to be put in a position where somebody asks me a question and I don't have an answer for them. But then it's an opportunity to really kind of broaden your knowledge about all these things and, become even more expert than you already are.
I made the decision early on to not feel stupid when I don't know an answer because I've always explained this to people in the past. Tech people do not have the answer to everything. Tech people just know how to find the answer. And that is the difference between someone that really loves technology is that they will dive in and figure out how something works. And I think that's the big difference is that I'm not trying to pretend that I have every answer in the entire world. I don't. But I will take that journey with you to find the answer and I'll figure out how to do it.
I love it. And definitely mirrors my experience with podcasting. There was a long time where I thought, if I'm going to be on a podcast, I should really know everything about the thing that I'm talking about, which, of course, is kind of impossible to know everything about everything. At a certain point, I had to kind of make friends with the idea that, like, you know what? There's a lot that I don't know that I won't know. And it's actually, for me, the better approach to just, like, go on that journey to discover the thing I don't know and learn more about it with the people who are listening and watching. So, and that's great. Well, it's great to have you here, Rich. It's great to have all three of you here. And we have some really cool stuff to talk about this week. Why don't we start by wishing ChatGPT a happy birthday. It turned one, still wearing diapers, but it turned one, I think it was on Thursday, the 30th of November. Can you believe how far we've come with this stuff in a single year? Like, that is really kind of crazy. This has been a really crazy year for technology. And ChatGPT really, you know, whether people love or hate it, really kind of seems to be the poster child for this current wave of the technology paradigm shifting. What has been... I don't know, Tim, let's start with you. What has been your experience with some of these tools and have you been working with ChatGPT and do you think all this energy around it is worthy of it?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how far we've come in just this year and the impact that ChatGPT and other, you know, associated language model technologies have had on so many different economies in the world in just that year. You know, the number of companies that have been upended, the number of, hiring freezes and layoffs that have been announced because as people are trying to really leverage these sorts of models in their businesses. It's pretty remarkable that we're only 12 months in. But as far as, on the daily basis, that kind of thing, I mean, I'm using the search plugins and that kind of thing more as just to see how they're evolving. But for my business, the only time that I've really used AI myself, you know, as a freelance writer, is to help me sometimes when it comes to research. I don't really trust these models to provide any information that I ever want to write, but I do trust them to help me find sources for information. So kind of like going to the librarian and asking, you know, what sort of things should I be reading if I want to learn about this technology or that technology. I found some interesting academic journals and that kind of thing through ChatGPT and through other services like that, that I probably wouldn't have been able to find as easily without them. So that kind of thing is useful, but we're still, I think, a really long way for me to be able to rely on those services to actually, you know, generate any actual content that I would feel comfortable including in any way, or even providing me any information that I would feel comfortable using without doing, you know, my own fact checking and that kind of thing.
Yeah, the fact checking is essential, as we know. These things do not spit out absolute facts, although they're very convinced that what they're spitting out is correct. Or they probably aren't even convinced of anything because they're not human beings. They're spitting out the next word that they think is the right word, based on, you know, the information that's been fed into them. And you do have to scrutinize that. Abrar, have these tools kind of made their way into any part of your process in doing what you do professionally or even personally? I mean, these things can be used for everything.
I feel like I'm being stubborn just because I'm like, you know, I'm intrigued but cautious about this technology. And so I haven't necessarily felt compelled to use it in my everyday life. I've played with it just to understand it. But I haven't used it for anything actually, you know, that could be helpful to me just yet. I don't know how long I'll be able to hold off just because it's going to be everywhere. And I feel like it's kind of turned into this meme where every tech company, every time they have an event, it's count how many times they say AI, because it's all anyone's thinking about. So it's not going anywhere. So I'm kind of figuring out what my relationship with these kinds of platforms should look like.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Rich? I'm super curious.
Well, I guess
you got your hands in a whole lot of different
things.
Here
because I have gone 100% full in. I pay the $20 a month for ChatGPT. I've got a tab open on my computer at all times with multiple ChatGPTs. I've built my own. I actually did something kind of cool. So I took all of the transcripts from my radio show and I programmed them into a GPT. And so I can ask my own GPT what I've said about a topic. I mean, it's literally like my brain on a computer. Now, it's not very good right now. Like, they're definitely having some, you know, like sometimes it'll get the answer right and other times it just won't even come up with the answer. Same question.
Right.
So it's not there just yet. But, you know, when it comes to professional and personal, like, I am using this like for everything. For my professional world, I mean, I get an interview, I transcribe it using AI. I'll have AI kind of pick out the highlights as my notes for that interview forever, in addition to what's in my brain. I don't use it to write things, obviously, because that's, you know, that's kind of like, I can't really trust it to do that. But headlines, Instagram, captions, pretty much anything where I want a creative partner on something, I will pull it. And, you know, you can't necessarily use what it comes up with immediately, but it just, it's almost like this just creative friend. It's like a writer's room at like a TV show, you know, it's like you have a bunch of people saying stuff and it's just giving you all this stuff all the time. And you're like, huh, okay, that's interesting. And so I've got it on my phone. I've got the app. It's just great. I really am so impressed with the variety of things I find to do with it, you know, travel and shopping and ideas, just everything.
And the more you use it, are you finding you're developing different skills around how to use it more effectively, how to trust what you're actually getting or what deserves more scrutiny and everything? Like I remember kind of throughout this year, it feels like longer because so much has happened in a year around, you know, generative AI and everything. But I remember in the beginning hearing about it and feeling like the mountain was too steep for me to get involved. Like I had some hesitation initially in actually using the tools. I was like, am I really, you know, going to learn this new thing? You know, maybe a little bit of self-doubt or whatever. But then once I started actually using it and interacting with it, I started to realize, oh, well, wait a minute, this isn't really that difficult, but it does require a certain skill set, not really a syntax necessarily, but a certain way of thinking about how I communicate with this computer, with this algorithm, in order to get the things that I want. And so I guess it is a certain type of syntax, but I certainly recognize, you know, as with everything, I suppose, the more I use it, the more I understand about it, the easier it becomes. And then at a certain point, it's like the playing field starts to open up. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Now that I kind of understand how to do it with these very like few minimal things, now that's when the imagination starts happening. I was like, well, wait a minute. I could use it for so many other things. I just have to figure out how to ask the right question. You know, the English is the programming language.
Yeah. That is a tricky part. I think the syntax is, and I don't have a very good like idea of like, okay, let me, so I have a couple of things I will ask as like basis, but I think the other beauty of it is the back and forth. So for instance, you know, my company sent me like, hey, here's all the changes to your 401k next year. And it's like 37 pages. I take that PDF, I just threw it into ChatGPT and I said, hey, what are the main things I need to know here? And then it was like, you know, you can just go back and forth and what's changed from last year or what's different or is there any red flags here? I mean, it's just, you're almost just asking kind of like the smartest person that you know using their base of knowledge. Like they've seen a bunch of these PDFs floating around the internet that they've somehow scanned and kind of categorized. But I think when you take it to that next level, like you're talking, when you do have the exact way to ask things, I have not gotten to that level, but that is a skill for sure.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm necessarily at that level either, but it's certainly something that I understand more the importance or kind of what you might be able to do as those skills, you know, progress and improve over time. Yeah, 1 year. Imagine what we'll see in five. It's really kind of remarkable kind of how quickly this has taken over. The other things we were getting excited about, or some people were getting excited about, things like, you know, the metaverse and, of course, crypto and everything. Does this feel different to you, Tim? Like, where do you stand? Like, you're not relying on these services necessarily right now. So I'm actually really curious for both you and Abrar. To a certain degree, that means that you're a bit removed from kind of the hypey quality of these tools, because once you start using them, in my experience, you can get really excited about the possibilities. Do you believe that this kind of moment with generative AI a year in from the birth of OpenAI is different than what we've seen in other hype cycles around things like, you know, crypto and blockchain and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think the main reason is that, you know, with crypto or with the metaverse or with all of the technologies like that, there has to be a big period of explaining why this is beneficial for you. And in a lot of cases, that's still happening. You know, I would still need to explain to a layperson why they should care about crypto. And the honest answer is they probably shouldn't. They don't really need to. Same thing with the metaverse. The metaverse is not really changing anyone's life yet. It's more about, if you adopt this technology, maybe down the road, it'll change your life. But right now, it's not really doing much for anybody from, you know, a serious productivity standpoint. So when we talk about, you know, large language models and things like that, and we talk about the sort of services that Rich was talking about or that I've been using for research, and I forget to mention, I've also used them for generating like simple legal contracts and things like that. That's a really tangible, immediate benefit that I can have right now. And it doesn't take more than 5 minutes to show somebody, here's how you use this thing, and they can immediately kind of get it. Whereas those other technologies require explanation, they require some nuance, and ultimately they often require some sort of financial investment, whereas ChatGPT is free to go play with anyway. So I think it's a lot easier for people to understand, but I think it's also easy for people to then make that leap that, you know, this is so great and it kind of came out of nowhere in the eyes of most people. And so therefore the expectation is that, well, if it went from 0 to 100 in 12 months, you know, what's it going to be like in another 12 months? And for sure, I think we should expect, you know, continued levels of improvement, things getting more and more interesting and exciting. But ultimately, as we've seen with AI learning for since the inception, since, you know, back in the days of Lisp programming and things like that, it's really easy to get to that impressive point, but to go from impressive to bulletproof is a massive task. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we're at right now, which is kind of, I think what you were saying, Rich, where it's really, really good, but it's not quite reliable to the point where you can kind of depend on it, where you would really want to run your life on it, that kind of thing. But it is really impressive, and you can absolutely see that potential, and you can also see the kind of the negative implications as well. I mean, the fact that the SAG strikes this year, that AI was such a major topic in those discussions back and forth, is pretty amazing, because if that had happened 12 months ago, 24 months ago, I don't think that would have been even on anybody's radar. And that, to me, I think speaks to just how widespread the understanding of this is versus something like cryptos and tokens and things like that.
Yeah, they are very different. the cryptos, that, you know, the blockchains, all that stuff is, it's obvious that some people have such a deep understanding of it that they can kind of conceptualize what that can lead to. Yet the everyday person, of which, by the way, I include myself as well, like, I love technology and I do technology podcasts, but at my heart, I'm like an everyday technology user to a certain degree. And when I look at what these AI tools are capable of, it's really easy for me to look into it and go, okay, I can list off 10 ways right now off the top of my head that I could use these things to make my work a little bit easier, to take the pressure off of, you know, finding the perfect gift for someone when I'm totally out of ideas, or any number of things. It's easy for me to draw a connection between those tools to something in my life. And I think that was a challenge largely when we're talking about crypto and blockchain and everything. Sure, you're telling me, yeah, it's a really big deal, but I have a hard time conceptualizing that and really understanding that, but I can hear, and that makes it feel like a bigger deal to me. What do you think about that, Abrar? Like, between the differences between some of these past hypes and where we're at right now, does that have you feeling any difference about where AI is headed?
Yeah, I fully agree with what Tim said, because it feels like I've been thinking a lot about what this shift that we've seen with Meta, for example. We're talking about the metaverse. For the longest time, they were touting it as, right, where we all wanted to be. And we didn't understand why, and we still don't fully understand why, especially when we are already, you know, the screen fatigue, Zoom fatigue, all of it's so real. So why would I want to be in a virtual world with people? And so I think with generative AI, it's clear. It's not only clear what the benefit is, but it's also so accessible. And it's, I mean, I think the closest thing that I could think of, and this isn't a direct parallel, but think of the way social media changed the world, where you can create a free account and you can interact with people in a whole new way. And that was a very strong sudden shift, and this is a very strong sudden shift that is accessible and meaningful, and will only continue to shape the ways that we act and interact with each other.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we're talking all about ChatGPT, and of course that is an OpenAI product, and it's kind of hard to not jump right into, you know, some of the craziness that we were all following just a couple of weeks ago. That one weekend, man, that was a crazy weekend when Sam Altman was fired from OpenAI, then hired at Microsoft, and now back at OpenAI, which none of that is really news as of the past week, although late this week, it was kind of like the official Altman is back announcement, and Altman, you know, Sam Altman making kind of comments publicly about how that all went down, kind of the changes of the board. There's a new board now, Brett Taylor, Larry Summers. The only surviving board member that remains there is Quora CEO Adam D'Angelo. And then Microsoft now has a non-voting observer role in the board. And so that, you know, I imagine that means that there's, you know, they have the ability to avoid some additional regulatory scrutiny in the regards to that. But they say they're commissioning an independent investigation to take a look into the events that took place. My question for anyone who chooses to take it and run with it is the impact of this event and the impact that this has on the board. We have this basically, for the most part, a new board with Microsoft kind of in more of a position of influence than they already were. They were pretty influential, I'd say, to OpenAI already. They're now kind of more closely intertwined. How do we feel about what this means for OpenAI going forward? I know Sam Altman has also made some comments like, you know, we're bigger and better than ever, typical CEO speak, but I think he really means it when it comes to this event being kind of a supercharged power for him and likely his vision for what the company needs to be. And now with this new board in place, what do y'all think as far as what we can expect from OpenAI moving forward? Considering all of this craziness,
it's really hard to know. I mean, I think, you know, the big tensions at least purportedly, were to do with profit and the, you know, the safety of these technologies, and are we moving too quickly and things like that. That's my understanding of why a lot of this came down as it did. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, my understanding is that it was the board's role to kind of pump the brakes on things. And so it's pretty clear that their attempt at pumping the brakes in a rather dramatic way was completely overturned. And so that makes me a little bit concerned about, you know, who's watching the watchmen? Not exactly, but I mean, you know, who's going to make sure that this technology is safe? Because it was ultimately the board's role to ignore profits and to ensure that this technology is being deployed in a way that we can all be comfortable with. With that out of the picture now, and with Microsoft stepping in as well, you know, Microsoft, I don't believe that Microsoft is evil in any way, but certainly they are a corporation and they want to make money. Mm-hmm. And so is that now the interest of the board? Is that now the prime directive of the board? That's my big question that I haven't found a good answer to. Maybe all of y'all have heard more on that front, but that's what I'm thinking of right now, and that's what I'm a little bit worried about as we come out of this.
Yeah, it really
there's no way this hasn't emboldened, you know, Sam Altman and the employees who were so vocal about, you know, how against this they were. So it's kind of like they have this extra fire lit under them to just kind of keep pushing for whatever's coming next. I don't know, but I don't know what that is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it really solidified the fact that Sam Altman is ChatGPT, is OpenAI, and no matter what, whether that company, I mean, I think it shows me two things. Number one, that company is almost like it was very fragile as an organization for this to happen. So that's concerning, especially for a company that has probably the most important product of the past 5 years. And so that's interesting. But it just goes to show that Sam is the superstar here. He is the foundation of this technology. He's the visionary. And, you know, we're starting to see this more and more in tech where it's like these sort of like outspoken individuals, not that he's outspoken, but it's like it used to be, you know, a technology company like Microsoft, you know, maybe a new Bill Gates, right? And mm-hmm. it's like, that's it. And it's just, it's becoming more and more where like these tech superstars are the superstars themselves and the tech is kind of intertwined with them. And that's what we're seeing happen here with him. And, you know, if he would have left that company and started his own thing, it would have really had some major implications. So I think they kind of really saved a bad thing from happening by having him back at that company.
Yeah, even if he had left and gone to work for Microsoft, which was, you know, for a short moment in time, the thing that was happening, it's just kind of crazy to me that the announcement was made and yet things still kind of ended up reverting back to normal. Because in the moment, it seemed pretty real. And I remember everybody, you know, hitting Twitter and everything, basically saying Satya is a genius, which he's a very, very smart man. But I think in the end, there was a New Yorker piece that I read that really shed some light on the fact that the board, that Satya really didn't want any of this to happen. And bringing Altman and the avalanche of employees from OpenAI that were willing, which was like most of them, that were willing to follow him over there, as much on the outside as that may have seemed like a huge, huge win for Microsoft, would have been an insane challenge for them to pull that off quickly. Satya really, you know, according to this piece, really wanted to kind of keep things the way they were for his for his interaction with the company.
Let's be honest. He was protecting a major investment
Absolutely.
To this company.
Absolutely.
And he did not want to look silly if it did not work out. And so I don't think Sam Altman would have survived at Microsoft. There's just no way.
I wondered how that would Microsoft, go too. Completely agree.
And all these employees, like they're going to absorb 700 employees or whatever, you know, however. I mean, it just, all of it was to sort of, you know, they were probably trying to figure out what they were going to do to save OpenAI as a company and keep it with Sam in place. And I think that was just kind of the stopgap, like, hey, everything's going to be fine. We're going to absorb all this. But they knew what they were really, what the goal was, which was to, you know, steer the board in their direction and, you know, make everything okay again.
Yeah. So super interesting kind of developments over time. There was also the mention of Q-Star, which is, you know, some people were saying possibly some sort of a breakthrough towards artificial general intelligence, if you believe that's a possibility. It had been leaked as potentially a part of the reason for Altman's ouster. But I guess it's since been debunked. In fact, Altman acknowledged the existence of QStars, calling it an unfortunate leak. That was in an interview just this last week. So apparently not that exactly, but I think that I think it's going to be really interesting to get a clearer sense of exactly why, if we will ever know. I mean, maybe we won't ever know exactly why he was he was fired in such an unprecedented way, but I can't imagine we won't get, you know, get the story at some point. It's just too big, and the implications are too big to not get that eventually.
We'll have to wait for the Showtime special in 20 years, I think.
Yeah, right.
The Isaacson book, the Showtime show.
It's all
be any human actors in the Showtime show.
No, yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, you know, now Hollywood, by that point, you're just firing up a machine and telling it this is the movie I want. And it just makes it right. Yeah, that's totally good.
And you won't even have to worry about getting actors that kind of look like the people, because you can just have a generated movie that looks exactly like the people because it's been fed images of the actual people.
There
so
we
that,
go.
That raises some interesting rights questions, but it should make for some interesting filmmaking.
yeah. I'm both curious and terrified because there's a part of me that's like, you know what? Like, I want to see a motion picture that's created in this way. I'd be super curious to see what that would turn into. But I also don't want the current, you know, the art that is filmmaking the way it is right now to go completely away because of that technology. So I don't know what I want when it comes to that. I don't know. I'm intrigued. That actually reminds me.
Yeah, I am too. I think we've all seen, you know, the TikTok shorts and things like that of the, you know, like the Star Wars in the Middle Ages and things like that, and all the amazing concepts, and they make for great, you know, 30 to 90 second clips. But the idea of something like that being drawn out to 2.5 hours right now, it doesn't really seem feasible. But honestly, you know, I think that the overall aesthetic of AI, the way that images shift and the kind of almost mind altering appearance of a lot of these things, I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes kind of an aesthetic that even some filmmakers try to replicate, because it is an interesting visual effect. And it's the kind of thing that you could see people resonating with and wanting to capitalize on, even if they're creating films by hand. So I'm interested to see what filmmakers do with this technology going forward, even if they are still, you know, holding the reins and making sure that the ultimate product is what they want. These tools, I think, could really result in some interesting filmmaking going forward and then in the real near future.
Yeah, well, we're already starting to see some real progress in this front, tangentially related, but definitely related to what you were just talking about. I have it a little bit later in the rundown. We'll talk about it right now. Pika 1.0, which is a video generation, AI generation system that launched after 6 months in beta. And basically, it's all about creating high quality video out of text. And there is actually a video, if you scroll down, I can't remember if that article, the TechCrunch article, has some video. But anyways, the clips that are coming out of this thing, you know, they're like 3 to 6 second clips that it's possible to create with this. And I mean, in some ways, they, you know, certain clips end up kind of rivaling, at least to some degree, what you could expect to see from like a Pixar cartoon or something along those lines. And then I did, Benito, put down below that article a little Twitter thread. That's from the TechCrunch article. I think that's direct from Pika Labs. And TechCrunch, I think, does some weird kind of dithering, so it doesn't look as
sharp. I was going to say, because they did not look very good from what I saw, but I saw a whole bunch of people tweeting them, and the tweets were pretty clear. But the ones that were embedded in that TechCrunch article, I was like,
yeah,
if this is the future, it is not very good.
Because no.
It was just like, it just looked like a really bad like animation or something. So, I do think this idea of creation with video is the next frontier. I mean, we've seen the pictures that DALL-E and Stable Diffusion and all these different services are creating. So video is kind of like that holy grail. And if you can make we're going to see a whole bunch of short form content that just relies on this, and it's going to get better and better. And it's going to inform a whole nother generation of people with these TikTok videos and stuff. So just like we have the AI voice, we have AI pictures, and now it's just going to be video too.
Yeah. Yeah.
For better or for worse.
Yeah. And a lot of social media sites, I believe YouTube Shorts and TikTok have disclaimers on videos that are used with generative AI, because it's just going to keep popping up in things. And it's, as it gets better, it's going to be harder to tell what, you know, used AI and what didn't.
Yeah.
But Abar, I'm sure you've been in the you know, edit situation where you need a clip of something, you know, like you're editing something. I need a video of someone just putting something in the mailbox, you know, obviously very dated, something you would need, but you know what I mean?
Yes.
But, you know, and you're just like, where do I get that clip from? And it's just, you know, you type it into a generator and you get that clip, and it may be part of a bigger video that you're doing, but it's, you know, it's just one of these things that we're going to take it for granted a year or two from now that you can just do that. And it's pretty wild. Just how do you say this? Pika or Pika?
I honestly don't know. I've been saying Pika, okay. But it could Pika. Be Pika. Yeah. But I mean, look at the video that's generated here. Now, granted, this is their promotional video. They're going to pull out the best of the best. But I mean, if these things were conceptualized text to image, or even if it was just, you know, in some cases they talk about how you could like draw an outline and turn that into an actual animated image. But I mean, this is pretty remarkable stuff.
This looks pretty incredible.
And yeah. This is where my mind starts going bonkers about this stuff, is to think that, you know, touching back on our very first story, to think that 1 year ago, the generative AI kind of movement as we've come to know it, in, you know, 365 days, began with ChatGPT, and I'm floored at the progress that we've seen in real time in 365 days, to where we are now using these tools. Well, I'm not using these tools to do this, but someone is using these tools to create pretty darn convincing video from text that looks like that a year in. It blows me away where we're at and where we're going. I don't know. Maybe I'm too hyped about this stuff. But the more I see, the more interested and intrigued I am to see where it leads. That's where I'm at.
Just want to keep my job. That's all.
Well, yeah. I mean, that is the real big concern, right? Because the more we see examples of this, the easier it is to, you know, consider like, okay, well, what does it actually mean? Like, okay, great, we've got this animated video, but that used to require a certain set of skills. That at least for people who don't have those skills, they don't necessarily have to hire it out anymore. Maybe that is good enough. But would those people have paid for that? I don't know. There's a lot really undetermined right now about what the impact of all of this is.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to watch.
Yes, but both can be true. Yes.
Yeah, both are true for me. But yeah. Interesting stuff. All right, let's take a break, and then we'll get back into more. I don't want to spend the whole show on AI. It's kind of hard because the news, the flood of news so frequently involves AI, but Amazon had a big announcement. We could talk about that. And then we can get into a little block that I have in here that's touching on some of the stories that each of y'all have some involvement with, because this is a cool little block that we have together that kind of came together during the setup of the show. So it's really great to have all three of you, Tim Stevens, Abrar Alhiti, Rich DeMuro. Y'all are great, and I just really appreciate you being here with me today while I'm sitting in for Leo. Well, let's take a break and thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Let's see here. It's A Wonderful Life, A Christmas Story, Elf, Christmas Vacation. To make these holiday classics, it takes a team of talented people, actors, editors, props people, sound crew, a whole lot more. I mean, you've seen the end of movie rolling credits. You know how many more. Sometimes it's insane how many people are on these teams. When it comes to building such a team, whether it's for the entertainment industry or a wide range of other industries, you really need to hire the right people to work with you. The best way to do that, of course, is ZipRecruiter. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Now, how does ZipRecruiter help you round up the brightest team for whatever job you happen to have? Well, they've got a number of different ways that they do that. Incredibly powerful matching technology. ZipRecruiter actually uses this to find qualified people for a wide range of roles. And then invites them to apply. So you can see top candidates that you're really interested in, and ZipRecruiter then makes it easy to send them a personal invite. That invite is kind of meant to encourage them to actually apply for the role that you have. It's inviting them in. It's saying, hey, you meet the qualifications. We are interested. Want to come over and check it out? And then finally, attention-grabbing labels. ZipRecruiter offers labels for your job post that speak to flexibility, things like remote. A lot of people are looking exactly for that. Training provided and more, so you get the applicants that you want, the applicants that you are looking for. Make your hiring a little merrier with ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Super fast, right? They've got an incredible pool of people. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. It's ZipRecruiter.com/twit. One more time, that's ZipRecruiter.com/TWIT. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire, and we thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. All right, one more, at least in the top of the fold, AI stories. I'm sure there's other stuff throughout here, but then we can kind of take a reprieve from AI for a little bit. But I do think that it's important to mention that Amazon held an event this week. It was the reInvent conference in Las Vegas, totally AI focused, new AI chips, as all these companies seem to be doing right now, which is interesting for other companies like Intel and others that are used to providing these chips. Amazon creating, you know, its own AI chips for faster, better performance, energy efficiency, all that kind of stuff. But they also introduced their own chatbot designed for business. They're calling it Amazon Q. And I've already spent my time on a couple of other shows over the last week ridiculing this constant need for big tech to pick the letter Q as their one letter name for their products. I don't know why that letter. I mean, I know why, because it's basically based on question, but still, it just seems like a weird letter to choose in this year. But anyways, all about customizing these chatbots for your business, which is similar to, you know, Rich, earlier you were talking about setting up your GPTs for very specific experiences and very specific purposes. This is kind of the same thing here, but intended for business to do that, you know, feed in all of your business documentation to create a very specific chatbot for just what you offer. Now, you have it, I'm assuming, Rich, that you've not played around with Q yet, but you have done with the GPTs. Do you think that this is a good approach for business? Do you think we're going to see a lot of this in the next coming year or two as businesses kind of learn why this might be beneficial for users to interact with?
Oh, yeah. Possibly? I mean, I think this is the only business in the next couple of years with companies, because, you know, like Amazon's trying to do, you can have your employee handbook. I mean, something as simple as your employee handbook online and ask questions. Hey, which days do I get off this year? Where do I sign up for this? Where do I go for that? But then when it comes to insights into the actual company, I think that's what Amazon is really trying to do here, is have you feed in all of your data. And then a salesperson can ask, hey, what was our, you know, third quarter like this year compared to last year? Stuff that you can do today, but it takes a lot of skill, takes a lot of spreadsheets, takes a lot of know-how. Mm-hmm. And this is going to just erase those boundaries. And what you were talking about earlier, Jason, is, you know, when it comes to these jobs and these, you know, the boundary to entry is just going to be so low, the barrier to entry. It's just going to open up an entirely new realm for people. You know, these prompts that people know how to ask, like, I know how to ask better questions to the GPT than you. You know, it's like you come in with that skill set, like you come from another company and you're like, hey, this kid knows what he's doing. He knows how to ask these questions in the right way to get the right answers that can help us, you know, improve our business. So I think there's a lot here. Amazon, you know, obviously with their AWS, they have an in with a lot of companies. So they've got that sales lead. And I think that's why they're doing this, because it's an easy add-on for companies that already do business with AWS.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I think I think you're absolutely right. The AWS connection is kind of key here. And also,
you know, but the other side is that trust thing. And I think you mentioned this, but it's, that's the main thing is that if, you know, if you're a CEO and you have certain access to stuff at this GPT that an entry level person should not, or a different department, that could be the troubling area of this. And we already know how these things hallucinate. There's got to be very clear boundaries between the data that these GPTs have access to and who they give this access to. And I think that's all part of what we're learning right now, is that I don't know if everyone has the answer to all that stuff just yet.
Yeah.
And well, I think companies are probably very hesitant.
Yeah. The platformer actually got a hold of some documents, some leaked documents, just a few days after this, you know, Amazon Q was announced, that really call into question its ability to be accurate. Also calling into question some privacy issues, leaking confidential data, severe, it said, inaccuracies of output that was reported. Amazon, of course, is pushing back on that, saying it has not leaked confidential information, but the internal document said Amazon Q can hallucinate and return harmful or inappropriate responses. For example, Amazon Q might return out-of-date security information that could put customer accounts at risk. So that trust element, super critical. Although there's a lot of people who are using AWS for their business that already have a level of trust enough to use AWS for their business. But you know, this is kind of
that's a different
story.
You know, yeah. AWS is a cloud storage depot. You know, it's not
right.
It doesn't have this little gremlin in there that's just, you know, going through all the data and then coming up with a GPT to kind of interact with that data. That is a whole different realm. And I think that it's, companies want this, but, and Amazon, you know, there's not too many stumbles you can take with this, because you only get one chance. And this is an area that people want, but we don't know what the implications are. You know, the employees' access, and what if it gets hacked? I mean, there's so many ramifications of having that much data at a GPT disposal.
Mm-hmm. A GPT or a Q or whatever it is. They're all getting into this kind of like customized, you know, specific chatbot specific to a purpose. So yeah, you'll see a lot more of them, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of the similar questions about its, you know, ability to keep things confidential and to, you know, keep being accurate in its output, as we see here. Is Amazon a little late to the party? I mean, I realize it's only been a year, you know, touching back on ChatGPT 1 year later, but Amazon, I don't know, it feels like maybe they're maybe a little late, but it probably doesn't matter, right? Because at the end of the day, it's all about the people who are really all in on the AWS platform.
Yeah, I still feel like it's pretty early days for this technology, and I don't think there's really a need to be on the bleeding edge, especially if, as Rich mentioned, you know, someone's going to stumble at some point, and I don't think anybody wants to be that company that stumbles. So I still think there's a lot of greenfield opportunities for this kind of technology within large corporations, and I hope that the reason that they're late is because they are taking their time and making sure that this stuff is safe, and it's not just that they're lagging behind and now they're trying to catch up desperately. But of course, only time will tell on that front.
Yes, indeed.
About the fact that we haven't really heard from Apple in terms of what it wants from AI, right? So there's still a lot of room for those big tech players to, you know, get their piece of the pie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, how about the other side of this? What about Google? The fact that they are late to this game because they want to be late. If you look at what ChatGPT and all these services have done to Google's search business, it is literally anti to everything that makes Google money. To get these answers on a page instantly without clicking, and of course clicking ads at the top of your feed. I mean, Google's entire business is to get you to click the top two or three links before you find your information and make money off of that, right? And so they knew early on when they saw this, because Google has been doing AI for 10 years now.
Yeah.
They knew that this was not something they wanted to come out with unless they were forced to do it. And now look, they already dismantled their assistant team because they're like, we don't need you guys anymore, because we know that the GPTs of the world are going to take this over. Yeah. And, you know, they've got Bard, which is just a tiptoe. They've got the generative stuff. But Google knows they need to make a move that is going to not ruin their entire bread and butter, which is, you know, the $70 billion they make from search ads or whatever it is. And, you know, they're in a very precarious position here.
What I would like to know is if Google is aware of what they're doing to all the other results that aren't paying, because ultimately, you know, if their generative AI is able to extract all the information that you need from a buying list or something, or a, you know, a buyer's guide, a holiday gift guide, that kind of thing. That's ultimately depriving that editorial site of revenue that would be used to ultimately keep that site alive. Mm-hmm. And so if Google's AI agents are good enough to prevent someone from clicking on that article, ultimately that'll drive that company out of business. And that'll mean that Google search results themselves will begin to dry up. And I haven't really heard a lot of discussions about what Google hopes to do about that kind of situation. That to me is disconcerting as well. Certainly they need to make sure that their ad revenue survives, but they also need to make sure that the internet survives. And certainly, you know, this technology has the potential to really upend things in a pretty catastrophic way.
Mm-hmm. That is such a great point, because right now we're feeding all of the stuff that from traditional industries into these search engines, you know, the search engines, and now the GPTs of the world. And so, like you said, Tim, when that new fresh data starts drying up, and all these buyers, you know, all these people like Wirecutter and all these companies doing this research and reviews and stuff, when that stops happening, now where does the you know, Bard of the world get their information? And it's a very, very scary thought when there's just no more, I guess there's no more buffet for them to feast on.
Yeah, there is, as I've seen anyway, no plans for OpenAI or any other company to share any of their revenue back with the sources of their language models. They've all been built on data that's been provided on the internet by, in large part, corporations or, you know, for-profit entities that made money from ad revenue or other sources, which will ultimately dry up. And so, you know, what's the plan forward? I haven't seen anything there. You know, AI is only as good as what you teach it. And if mm-hmm. the original content that's going into these models is dead, then how will these things continue to evolve? That's what I'm wondering.
They'll feed off the output of all the other AIs. It'll just be one giant feedback loop.
It's like that meme where the make it more, you know, it's just like the first answer will be like the pizza eating the earth. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, wait a second, that's not what I meant.
Oh boy, the future looks dim right now. Yeah, the outlook looks not so good. All right, let's get out of the AI waters for a little bit. Let's talk about the Cybertruck. I think we got to talk about the Cybertruck because this was a kind of a big week for the Cybertruck. Say what you will about the Cybertruck, but it's actually happening. And I know over the last couple of years, people have been like, you know, wondering / doubting, like, are we ever going to see the Tesla Cybertruck? Apparently, there was a delivery event that was live streamed earlier this week. Select customers, you know, people like, I don't know, Alexis Ohanian. So, you know, big namers, I imagine, to get the press, got theirs, I guess. It's been 6 years since the first tweet of the Cybertruck happened. And Tim, you wrote all about the Cybertruck. You said, don't hate the Cybertruck, hate the game. Tell us about it.
There's been a lot of backlash about the Cybertruck, and certainly I've been, you know, responsible for some of that myself, because it's hard to not be disappointed by how long this took. I mean, it was promised. It was launched in 2019. I was at the event there where they rolled the thing out and where they, you know, famously threw the giant steel ball at the glass and broke the window.
Oh,
you know, I was there. And the initial promise was a $40,000 truck that'll do 250 miles of range, or the high end was going to be $69,000 for the 500 mile range truck. And what we instead got was a 250-mile truck for $61,000 on the low end. That's the cheapest one. Or if you want an all-wheel drive Cyber Beast, you're going to be spending $100,000, and none of them are going to go 500 miles of range. The only way that you're going to get close to that is if you pay extra for an additional battery pack that will fit in the trunk of the truck, and that will ultimately decrease your cargo space and make this truck that's already, I think, knocking on 7,000 pounds, it'll make it even heavier. Okay. So substantially more expensive, at least 50% more expensive than was anticipated, with less range than was promised. And of course, it's wildly late. It's also, the build quality of those initial cars is, as expected, not very good from what we've seen so far. And it's hard not to be disappointed. But ultimately, you know, my reaction to this isn't so much about the state of the truck. We all knew it was not going to be as good as what Musk promised 4 years ago. The fact is, you know, Tesla's still going to sell every one of these things that they can make. Tesla is ultimately going to make a lot of money on this thing. And to me, it's pretty disappointing that ultimately there's going to be no accountability for those missed dates, those failed promises. Now, this will just be another success story for Tesla down the road that will ultimately just encourage Elon Musk to continue on making bombastic promises that prove to be completely false, and no one's ever going to be held accountable for, which is a little bit unfortunate to me. And I also think it's a bit of a bummer that this is basically a giant rolling brick with no kind of creature comforts involved or no sensibilities when it comes to actually working as a truck. And none of the tests we've seen so far have been focused on hauling cargo, towing things, going off-road, any of that stuff. It's all been about how quickly can it go down a quarter mile? Is it faster than the Hummer? Stuff like that. And that to me is a little bit boring.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a truck, compare it against things I want to do with the truck. That makes a lot of sense. I like that you called it a giant rolling brick. That's my new favorite way of referring to the Cybertruck. Abrar, is the Cybertruck in your future? Do you have what are your thoughts on this thing?
I've actually got one in the driveway right now.
Oh, you were one of the people. Well, that's the lead right there. We buried it.
Goodbye, Bart. This is my new way of getting around town.
There you go. Yeah, the obvious second to Bart is the Cybertruck.
Obviously. No, it's fascinating to you know, watch the social media storm as all of this unravels. And it's I don't know. I mean, I'm not a car person. I can just tell you I think it's ugly. And that's the insight that I can give you today. That's all I can contribute.
that's about most of what I could contribute to. Every time I look at it, I keep waiting for there to be some sort of like refinement of something. I'm not sure what it is, but to my eyes, it just never looks right. What do you think, Rich?
I don't know. I'm trying to collect my thoughts on this Cybertruck. Tim painted a pretty grim future for yes. this thing. But I live in Los Angeles. I think that, you know, and Alexis lives here, I believe. I think, you know, one of the first buyers, I think he's here in LA. And so I just see this as a car that is a showpiece for eccentricity, and people will get it because it looks different. It's unique. It looks like something out of a sci-fi, you know, movie. And I think that's where it ends. I think that with Tesla, they have used a lot of the knowledge they gained from building the millions of Teslas out there. And that enabled them to make this platform. Yes, it's not as good as we had hoped with the mileage and the price and all of that stuff. But I think this just goes to show, I don't know. Again, I'm like, I just don't really understand like the reasoning behind this thing. Like, what is it, just for fun? You know, like you said, we're not really promoting, like nobody's getting this to tow their boat, you know, or to like actually work or anything like that with a pickup in the back. So it's interesting, but I think that to me, it's not that exciting.
Tim, in your piece that you just that you published today about this, you linked to the your first, I think it's your first write up from 4 years ago when we kind of, you know, got some interesting, you know, some more information about this. And you mentioned that you were swept up in the hype of the moment. What excited you about the Cybertruck back then? And I'm assuming that your current state of kind of view on the Cybertruck is because they didn't live up to that. What do we not have here that it seemed, at least at the time, that they were going to deliver on?
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember this was 2019. This was years before even the Rivian R1T came out. The F-150 Lightning didn't exist. There really was no electric trucks on the market at all. So this was a completely novel product at the time. So the fact that it was an EV with any semblance of the productivity of a truck was promising just from the beginning. And then the idea that it would be priced less than $40,000, which was about the same price as a base F-150 at the time, and do 250 miles of range, which is quite good, that made it a really, really compelling product. And that's why I think we saw so many of those initial pre-orders come out, because this was going to be, you know, on par with the price of a base F-150 effectively for this wild-looking, high-performance, all-electric truck. And so even though I thought it was pretty ugly at the time even, I was very excited by the potential, and I genuinely really wanted one. But fast forward 4 years, now it costs, you know, $70,000 instead. Mm-hmm. Now that we have the F-150 Lightning on the market and you know, doing reasonably well, at least from a standpoint, and having the F-150 that is a product that is designed from the outset to be a practical, usable thing. That they've put a lot of thought into how can we make a truck that is the kind of thing that can go to a job site, that can power a job site, that can keep a contractor from having to rent a generator, for example. They can just use their truck to power the job site. They can charge tools in the front as they're driving to that job site, stuff like that. A lot of smarts went into the F-150 that are based on 100 years of making trucks for people that want to get actual work done. And I also respect that. Whereas the Cybertruck is basically, like I said, Jason, it's a big toy. And so it's basically a big ugly sports car. And so, you know, if you want to
buy
a sports car
forever, big ugly sports
car. Right. I mean, if you want a sports car, why do you want something that is that ponderously large? If you want something that goes quick, fine, buy a sports car, buy a Model S Plaid, buy something like that that is more optimized for doing that kind of thing. Why do you need to make a 7,000-pound car go 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds? Mm-hmm. It's ultimately because they can. And there is this kind of growing segment within the truck industry. It's kind of taken over the truck industry of creating these massively unnecessarily large chrome-plated, incredibly overpriced luxury trucks that are absolutely far bigger than are needed. And ultimately, you know, again, you can draw parallels to sports cars. The sports cars are faster than you need and that kind of thing. But when you're talking about a really large truck that is unnecessarily large, you're talking about actually creating safety issues for everybody else on the road. Whereas a little sports car, if you screw up in your sports car, you might go crash in a ditch. You might hurt yourself. If you crash in a 7,000-pound Cybertruck, you're probably going to create some real damage for a lot of folks around you too. And that's a little bit what I'm kind of getting into. Instead of just becoming, you know, instead of just being a demonstration of your hubris or your ego, now you're actually being a bit of a public menace potentially. And I'm curious to see what happens.
You could say the same thing about driving an Escalade or Suburban or any of these.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're, you know, and I think for the occupant inside, and I'm not sure what the safety rating is of the Cybertruck, but I'm sure, you know, Teslas generally are very safe in crashes. But I think there's a bigger thing happening in America with this obsession with cars that we don't need and size that we don't need. And when I saw the, I actually had a similar reaction to the electric Hummer when I saw that. I'm like, what is the purpose of this? Like the Hummer brand at some point when gas was 99 cents was, you know, the car to have. And here in Los Angeles, it was everywhere. And now if you see one, if someone, you know, purchased one and whatever, they still have it, it's like, you see that as like, wait, seriously? And with the electric, I'm just like, I didn't really understand that change. Like that, to me, that just meant like excess. And all of a sudden now you're bringing an electric brand. Like, I feel like companies should be smarter than this. And maybe it's just what people want. But to me, it just seems weird that you would bring that Hummer brand to an EV. And it just means to me that people just want it to show off. Hey, I have a Hummer and it's electric and cool. It's got a moon foot in the, you know, whatever. They had like that secret moon stamp in the wheel well or something. I don't remember what they told me about that. Anyway, I love seeing those giant trucks though, Tim, the ones you were talking about. It's like the, you know, the American edition or all. It's just like, it's literally like a $100,000-$200,000 truck that is going down the freeway. And it's just like, this has never seen a speck of dirt in like an actual like truck area. It's just like, you have this giant truck because it's, again, excess.
Where I live out in the country, I see, you know, trucks are probably the majority of the cars that I see on the road, and a substantial percentage of those are HD trucks, you know, the 2500s, 3500s, that kind of thing. And yeah, it's mostly just dudes commuting to work.
Right. It's a commute vehicle. It's just a really big one and it matches my personality, you know, something like that.
Yeah. That's what a lot of, I mean, but sports cars are the same way. I mean, come on. It's like, there's cars have this thing where it's just like, it's not just a way to get around. If it was, we'd all be driving a little tiny smart car. Cars are an extension of someone's personality. And in America, especially, people like different things and they like stuff that they think reflects them. And it's just how it is. And I guess these companies definitely play to that. And that's what the Cybertruck is doing.
Yeah, and I totally appreciate that. And I think that ultimately truck should reflect your personality. Otherwise, it would be a pretty boring place. But at the end of the day, my concern is when it becomes a safety issue. And when we look at these 2,500 trucks and things like that, the sight lines on them are really, really bad. I had the Silverado 2500 HD not that long ago. And the hood line is basically at my chin level when you stand, you know, when I stood next to it. And that is incredibly tall on a truck that has no need to be that tall. Because if you pop the hood on it, the engine is sitting a good 6 inches below the hood. And there's a hood scoop on the front that you think, oh, well, that hood scoop there is, you know, making sure that the engine stays cool. Actually, no, the hood scoop is completely blocked off. It's just there for looks. So there's absolutely no need for that truck to be as big as it is. Therefore, you know, inflating effectively the ego of the owner. And that's unfortunate. I remember a long time ago when PCs were first going mainstream, Walmart did a study and they found that people would pay more for a larger PC. So there was a while there that Walmart was selling these really big PC cases, and then you'd open them up and there'd be nothing inside of them. And that's all that I can remember is that kind of thing. When I look at these 2500 trucks and HD trucks that are just wearing all this egregious extra bodywork just to make them look big and macho and tough, when in reality, they're really not that much more capable than a much smaller, much more affordable truck. So when we get to the point where the size, the expression of your character is becoming a bit of a risk to those around you, I think at that point, there has to be something done. I don't think, you know, someone driving their Porsche, yeah, maybe outrageously quick, but the shape of that Porsche is not necessarily causing a risk to anybody else around them. And that's what I'm concerned about here. Mm.
That's a really great point. It really, and especially going back to your comment or your label as an oversized brick or however you put that, like, you know, just the density and the mass of that giant brick moving down the road. If something happens, you know, that's going to create a different type of damage than the standard vehicle that might get into an accident. That's a really important thing to know for sure. Okay. Well, that is fascinating. We do have stories that you put in here, Rich and Abrar. We're going to get to those in a second. Let's take a quick break and thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech. This episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. And, you know, Stamps.com is excellent. It also happens to be a really great time right now for Stamps.com because, you know, it's the holidays, right? This would be a really wonderful way if there's someone in your life that's dealing with a lot of postage, shipping a lot of things from home. Stamps.com has been helping businesses like yours save time and money during the holiday rush. For 25 years, they've been doing this with easy access to USPS and UPS services and premium rates for all your postage needs. The holidays, we all know because we're in the midst of them right now. They're hard enough. Make things easier than ever with Stamps.com. Stamps.com has been with us forever. They've been a partner of this show since 2012. If you haven't tried them yet, well, what are you waiting for? Now is the time. Stamps.com offers premium discounts and supplies at your fingertips. So when you're running low, you can just order shipping and mailing supplies, labels, even printers from their supply store. You can get huge carrier discounts up to 84% off USPS and UPS rates. And that's really going to impact your bottom line. And Stamps.com automatically tells you your cheapest and fastest shipping options. So you don't need to, you know, remember to load up all your stuff and go to the place where you can find out. The place that you can find out is home because you got Stamps.com. Get your own personal post office wherever you are with Stamps.com. All you need is a computer and a printer. They even send you a free scale, so you'll have everything you need to get started. Now, taking care of orders on the go is even easier because Stamps.com has their mobile app. If you need a package pickup, you can easily schedule it through your Stamps.com dashboard. And if you sell products online, Stamps.com seamlessly connects with every major marketplace and shopping cart. So give your business the gift of Stamps.com. That way, your mailing and shipping is covered this holiday season. You can sign up with promo code TWIT for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. You just go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page and enter code TWIT and you'll get that offer. And we thank stamps.com for their continued, like I said, since 2012, their continued support of This Week in Tech. All right. So, Rich, let's talk about your story that you put in that you actually wrote about earlier this week, and that I am not on Apple devices. I mean, I've got a MacBook. My computing is Apple, but my mobile is Pixel. So I have not had any interaction with Apple's new name drop feature. Apparently, a lot of people, a lot of like sheriff's offices and everything on Twitter were like putting out big warnings about this new name drop feature for the iPhone. Tell us a little bit about what that actually means, and was it at all warranted? What do we know?
Last weekend, actually a week ago today on a Sunday, and I woke up and all of a sudden I get all these emails from people saying, hey, Rich, is there any truth to this? And, you know, it's like a Facebook warning that you see. And anytime I see tech news distributed on Facebook as a warning, I'm that it's like there's something wrong with the, with the advice.
Yeah.
And so I kind of looked through it and I'm like, well, I know about this feature, but I haven't really used it. But let me just see if it's working the way they say it's working. And it's coming from sheriff's departments saying that if your phone is near someone else's iPhone, you know, they can steal your contact information. And I was like, well, I don't think that's how it works, but let me test it. So I grabbed my wife's iPhone. I'm like, putting these phones together, seeing if this happens the way they say it does, and it doesn't. And so I'm like, all right. And so the warning was that this name drop feature is an extension of AirDrop. It's on by default in iOS 17. And if a stranger got near your phone, they would steal your email, your phone number, whatever, right? And they said, make sure you turn this feature off. And more importantly, turn it off on your kid's smartphone because, you know, they're at risk as well. Your kid is probably smarter than you, by the way. So it would be less apt to happen to them. Long story short, the only way this feature works is if two phones are placed really close together. It activates the feature, which does a vibration and a bubble up on your home screen. Your phone has to be unlocked for it to happen and for the sharing to happen. And you have to press a share button and you choose what information is shared. So none of this is happening automatically. None of it's happening without people sort of realizing that it's happening. But by then, the damage was done, and you know it came out to be pretty much fake news.
So it's on by default, but you do have to turn it off. But the only way that any sort of transfer of anything can happen is you have to basically confirm it, essentially.
There is a little nuance to the way it would activate, and so with the newest iPhones, they have an always-on display. Some of them do, and some don't. And so your phone has to be either lit up if it's an always on, you know, like kind of like there's different levels of like your iPhone being kind of on, right? There mm-hmm. The screen is lit, but it's still locked, or your screen is completely dark and it's locked. But for it to activate, for this feature to even trigger, both phones have to be in a state where they have sort of been moved and like active. So it's a weird little nuance, but again, nothing is happening without your phone physically being unlocked and also you pressing share. So it's just one of these things that I think it was an easy win on social media because it looked like these sheriff's departments were being very smart in helping people when in reality they were just scaring people into turning off this feature that no one even knew about or cared about. It's not like everyone's even using this feature to exchange phone numbers. So The whole story is just so weird, but it's like it was basically people trying to have an easy win on social media by helping people that turn out to be just completely fake and false.
Yeah.
It's funny because actually like just a couple weeks ago, I was shooting a video. So I had my personal phone and then I had a work phone to shoot with and I was carrying them and this name drop feature kept getting activated. And I was like, this is so annoying. There has to be a way to turn this off. There's no warning at this point. I just thought it was annoying. So I did a video on how to turn it off. Fast forward to this week or last week when it's all these like, you know, security threats. And I'm like, it's just an annoying feature. It's not, don't worry about it. But if you want to turn it off, you know? So it's kind of funny to see how it's exploded.
Yeah. But I think the intention, the idea behind it, like I can kind of get behind, right? Like how many times have I been with someone and it's like, hey, can I get your contact info? Yeah, sure. I'll go ahead and call you on my phone and then I'll hang up. And then you go into your call roll and you find my call that I hung up on. And then you add my contact. It's like this whole kind of like convoluted, like hacky way of doing it with little effort, even though there's a decent amount of effort there. It's a little convoluted.
There's no easy way when you want to exchange your phone number with someone. Like everyone has a different way. Some people will, you know, email themselves. Some people will do what you're saying, which is call. Some people will text.
Right.
I mean, so Apple, when they actually released this feature at WWDC this year, I was in the audience and people were clapping. Like people were so excited at this idea and everyone completely forgot about it because in reality, I mean, if you say, oh, let me bump my phone up to yours, like unless everyone is up to speed with like every new iOS feature, people are going to be like, no. And like, I mean, yes, I get iPhone is very prevalent, but there's Android out there. There's people that aren't on the latest software. And it's, again, I think 99% of people forgot about this. And then the only way they discovered it is like you did, where you put your phone next to another one and you're like, why is this doing this? How can I turn this off? It's annoying.
Right. And at that point, you're discovering it, but without any actual context. Like, does it even like tell you, Abrar, like when that happens, like, this is what this is useful for?
Yeah, it'll like, it'll do that little glitch and then it'll ask if you want to, you know, name drop. And I'm like, I literally don't. It would never occur to me. I mean, again, I think it would be convenient, but it's not ever something that crosses my mind. And I think you're right in terms of people forgetting about it, just because there were a lot of iOS 17 updates and we're not going to keep tabs on all of them. And I feel like, you know, when it comes to those updates, I remember once I was trying to use the check-in feature, which is, I think, a feature that is actually useful, where, you know, your loved ones can make sure you get home on time. And everyone was like, I don't even know what iOS 17 is. And you're like, oh, okay. I need to remember that not everyone really cares about these features.
So it's interesting as I'm thinking through this, because we were talking in pre-show, Abrar, you have a Samsung phone, and actually this will kind of veer into the story that you added, but you have a Samsung phone, right? And I know, because I've used a lot of Samsung phones over the years, I've never really had a Samsung phone as my like personal, like always go-to phone, but I have had a lot of experience with Samsung phones to know that like sometimes with features like this, if Samsung were to have a name drop, and who knows, maybe they do.
They will next year.
Yeah, exactly. fair point. But if they did, I think the Samsung way often, at least in the past, I don't know if it's still like this, would be to give you some sort of like a little helpful like pop out thing like, this is name drop. It is useful, blah, 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 blah. Do you want to keep it on? Or basically to give you these kind of like, some people would call it intrusive. Other people, at least in the case of this, that might actually be helpful. A little bit of extra context. So it's kind of like, stuck at, you know, there is no perfect path to please everybody, because on one hand you're telling me everything as it happens on my phone and it's annoying, quit talking to me, and on the other hand it's, oh, here's a feature that I didn't know existed, thank you, now I understand it, now I'll use it. And I can also understand from Apple's perspective, because Apple's all about ecosystem and getting everybody, you know, these features, in order for them to be truly useful, you kind of have to have them on the majority of the phones, right? Because then it will actually work when you try and do it. So I can understand kind of where they were coming from, but I don't know. What are your thoughts from a Samsung perspective? Am I at all near like how Samsung does things nowadays as far as warnings like that are concerned?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I really think it's damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of mentality. But I my personal phone was a Samsung phone for about 10 years. And then it switched to an iPhone last year, but I still have a Samsung phone that I use for work.
That's
so
right.
I'm still, you know, kind of entrenched in that ecosystem. But I think you're right in terms of, you know, there's only, unless you're sitting there watching the developers conference or you are entrenched in the world of tech, how are you going to find out about these features? How are you going to know to go into your settings, to do this thing? Or if you come across a video that tells you about this hack, you know, but I think if you do want something to be more widespread, if you want something to catch on, then it does have to automatically be enforced. There was something that was, I think it was called Energy Saver for iPhone last year, which I don't know if I got that title right. It's been a minute, but it was a feature. It is a feature where when you plug in your iPhone, sometimes it'll tell you it will finish charging later on. And that's, you know, depending on when it's the best time to charge and electricity use. There are lots of things that go into that. But I remember people were really upset about that because they just wanted their iPhones to charge. And there's an easy toggle that you can hit to turn that off. But it was on by default. And I think Apple thought, hey, this is a really helpful thing. We're just here to help you. And people didn't feel that way. So it's hard to gauge what people actually want you to automatically roll out and what they would rather opt into themselves. And so you kind of learn by trial and error.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't aim to please everybody. It's just not going to work. Yeah. That's right. You were on Samsung, now are on iPhone, which is the perfect segue. So you put in a story that you wrote not too long ago about 1 year ago, probably about the time the ChatGPT was born. You made the official switch from Samsung, from being an Android user using Samsung, to using the iPhone, and you know, checking in on it 1 year later. How has that been going for you? What were your reasons for switching, and what are you thinking?
Yeah, my iPhone and I are very happy together. We're happy to ring in this 1 year anniversary. So the reason I switched was very petty, and I will acknowledge that. And the reason was, I was just tired of being harassed for turning text green and ruining group chats and not being able to do FaceTime calls, even though I am fully aware that WhatsApp exists and Skype exists. I tried to defend myself for as long as I could. But at a certain point, you realize it would make communication easier if people actually wanted to reply to your texts. And again, it's petty. There's no other explanation for it. But since I've switched, I actually have noticed a difference in being included in group chats and people not having to scold whoever turned it green and being able to hop on impromptu FaceTime calls. And AirDrop has been a game changer. That is really useful for me because I use a Mac for work. And so, you know, shooting videos on my phone and then AirDropping them, it just makes it all a lot more seamless. So it's been a good journey. I will always have a place in my heart for Android phones. Again, I still use them on the side for work. But in terms of communication and just because everyone else has an iPhone, it's why I caved. And it's a really sad reason. But, you know, it is what it is.
It is what it is. And I don't think that you're alone. I think that, you know, the messaging aspect has brought a lot of people or opened up a lot of Android users into that. I mean, I fight it on my Android phone constantly. If I end up in a group messaging, a group where I'm messaging other people that are on iPhone. Yeah, like I have the weirdest, you know, the low res images thing. Sometimes it just like, it's almost like it knows that it's a group message with other iPhones because the SIM gets confused. And so I'll send a message and it won't complete sending until I restart the phone. Things like that, that just over time, again and again, it gets really, really annoying and exhausting. It's almost like it beats you down and you're like, okay, fine, I relent. But
yeah, I forgot about that element where I would run into the issue if there was more than one person in the group. And at some point when I messaged enough times back and forth, it would just stop sending my texts and I would just have to wait until it decided to participate again. I completely forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me. But yeah, the low res images and videos, the videos looked like videos that I had sent back in like 2008 on my like LG NV3. And it's just like, it's like tiny on the screen. It's grainy. But hey, you know, Apple is adopting RCS. So hopefully that gets better.
Well, yeah. So we've got Apple adopting RCS, which we've talked about in previous shows. We actually do have some RCS news, some actual this week news. Google announced a new milestone. More than 1 billion monthly active users use RCS in Google Messages. Now, of course, Google Messages is kind of Google's default messaging, like text messaging app for Android. So if you're getting an Android device that has Google's suite of apps and services, is GMS certified, then it is probably going to have Google Messages as its default. So 1 billion active users actually isn't that surprising. But what that ultimately means is that all of those users, or the majority of them with a current version of Android Messages or Google Messages, is RCS supported, so has the ability to communicate with each other via RCS. But so that's good.
This entire conversation is just so draining. I'll be honest, it's so draining because consumers are in the crosshairs here, and Abar, you have fallen into the trap of Apple, which is exactly what they want you to do, which was to give up and to switch because it just became so frustrating. And you are representative of so many people out there that begrudgingly give up their Android phones with great features and, you know, a lot of choice, and go over to Apple because it's just simple and you're able to message, which should be a fundamental human right on a smartphone, to have your messages work the same way across every phone. Now, I understand that they've adopted RCS and things will get better, but the fact that we have had to live with this long national nightmare for so long, and to really just make this divide between like everyday people in sports clubs, in children's family, you know, groups of school kids, you know, your family, whatever, family members. My brother and I made the decision a long time ago to switch to Telegram with our family members. We have I have a lot of people in my family, and we literally just sat everyone down during like a holiday and said, "You're all downloading Telegram." They said, "Why? We have this app, this messages app." And I said, "No. that you don't understand. Like, we want to be able to use whatever phone we want. And at the time he was Android, I might've been as well, but you know, it's just one of these. Anyway, the experience has been amazing, where the photos work, the videos work, the reactions work, everything works the same. And it should always be that way. I just find this so sad that, like, this messaging thing has become such a huge deal in the world, you know, basically America, really. It's not really the world.
In the US, yeah.
No. But it's just I hear this over and over, and I just, it's like, it's tiresome, because I just feel like Apple executives are just sitting there just like, you know, just like, yep, this is exactly what we sort of engineered and we love it. And by the way, I'm reading your article about the removing the thing from the image. There's a great app called Touch Retouch, which is I mean, I know that Apple, Google now has the Magic Eraser on all the phones, so you don't really need that as much. But anyway, Touch Retouch is a great app if you just want to remove something from a photo quickly, and it works great.
Okay, I will definitely keep that in mind. Thank you. Yeah, because that is a super handy feature.
I'm done going off.
But I think the thing is, the pettiness will continue likely, because even, you know, when Apple adopts RCS, we will probably still see different colored bubbles if somebody is on an Android phone. Uh-huh. And so, like, they have no intention, it seems, to, you know, get rid of the bullying that happens with something that's really not, that shouldn't be that important, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. And it is Apple. They will find some way to make a frustrating little change that is just frustrating enough where you're like, oh, this is good, but it's still not great. But hopefully, I do have hope that because they are adopting the standard, if you are an Android user on RCS and you text an iPhone and you send a big picture or a video, it will show up on the other end just the same. The typing indicators will be there. So like 99% of it will be great. I still think that group messaging aspect is not going to be that great, because I think there's still going to be a delineation between the iMessage users and the RCS users. I'm not sure that I've read anywhere that the group messaging on iMessage is going to include the RCS. Like, I'm not sure that's going to be blended in. So we'll have to see how that works.
That'll be a really big consideration, because that, I think that's one of the things that I run into most these days. It's that, and it's the resolution of the images. The Android messaging VP is Sanaz Ahari told The Verge some of the features that we won't likely expect to come to for RCS conversations between Android and iPhone, based on where the standard spec is right now. Things that we won't expect, of course, no end-to-end encryption, which we've all kind of realized that at this point, that will be not there because it's not part of the standard spec. Threaded replies, read receipts. I thought that one was a little weird. I was like, wait a minute, read receipts?
I thought that was part of the protocol.
Yeah, that's a really weird one. And then reactions, which
I was also disappointed by, for that not to be baked in. All we can do is high-res images and videos. Is that all we're getting? Like, that's not worth it.
It goes back to what you were saying, Rich, where it's like Apple's like, okay, fine, we'll give you RCS, but we're not going to give you any more of RCS than we absolutely have to. And I think at the end of the day, what that means is hopefully the actual standard RCS spec, and I know Google's working hard to make this happen, can be improved so that it includes some of these things, because then they would appear there. How do you stand on this, Tim? Because you are an Android user, correct?
Android through and through. You know, I used to do the iPhone reviews every year at Engadget, and I did that at CNN for a little while too. And every year I think, oh, this will be the year that I go to iPhone, and it never really stuck. I always went back to Android. So, I've never felt the peer pressure. I don't know if I have more accepting friends, or maybe I'm just not on as many text lists as y'all are. But I've never really felt that pressure. So I really can't relate, honestly. And that feels honestly really tragic and awful that someone would drive you from your platform of choice to another one. Mm-hmm. I hope that this RCS stuff helps, and I hope that, but with Apple, you know, open the gate a little bit, it'll help to ease the tension, but it doesn't sound like it's going to, and that's really disappointing. But again, it's not something that I can honestly relate to. So, I listen with eager interest, but I'm very happy on Android. I don't upgrade every year. I've got the 23 Ultra at this point, which I upgraded from the 22 just because I wanted the better battery life, and it has been really spectacular in that regard. I'm not really looking to jump ship. I'm not really, wholly ingrained or in love with what Samsung's doing, but the hardware is good, and I'm happy.
Yeah.
I salute you.
We salute you. Yeah, I'll be really curious to see kind of when Apple finally announces kind of like how they're going to approach this. I don't think that it gets rid of the green bubble. I think that has to stick around because there is a delineation between the services that Apple offers versus even with RCS. You know, there's differences there. And, you know, those colors, they exist for a reason. They're not just there for ridicule, even though, you know, some people take it there. They really do exist to assure you, if you're using iMessage, that there's a certain feature set that's active right now that you can expect. And, you know, some of those are really important to know, like end-to-end encryption. So I don't think that's going anywhere. But I do not want to talk about Musk and Pizzagate. I really don't. Do we have to talk about it?
No.
Okay. No. Yay. Moving on. I'm down with that. We don't have to do that. It's just not fun. Let's see here real quick before a break and Apple related, I suppose, Apple Card. Again, I'm not an Apple user, so I haven't used the Apple Card, but apparently Apple is pulling out of its partnership with Goldman Sachs, which is its credit card partnership. So that's going away. I don't know what they replace it with. I haven't seen any news as far as what that means for the Apple Card itself.
Well, it's not happening for, you know, number one, it's I don't know if it's confirmed, but they said it was like 12 to 15 months before this is changing. I think the big question for consumers is really like, you know, is the Apple Card going to continue? Which I think the answer is yes. And what company is going to buy this business? You know, I think there's no shortage of financial companies out there that are willing to take the leap with Apple. And Goldman was an odd choice to begin with. I think they were kind of like the back in the day when the iPhone launched. Remember, it was on like, what was the brand? Was it AT&T or was it Singular back then?
It was AT&T.
They right? just, you know, yeah. basically said, we will let you do whatever you want with this phone. We will just give you that line. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Apple tried to do with this card was they wanted to find a partner that would say, look, we're going to rewrite all the rules of a credit card. And, you know, will you come along this journey with us? And clearly it didn't work out for, I'm not sure why, but there will be another card, you know, company that will just scoop this up. And maybe there'll be some changes to the way the card works, but otherwise, maybe they'll be smarter and it'll just work out better.
Bloomberg saying Chase Bank would be an ideal replacement, but I don't know if that's just an opinion piece or whatever. But
now, I think that was Gurman today said that. I think the bank that's going to take it is that Synchronicity, the one that does all like the store cards, you know, like the Gaps and the, mm-hmm. you know, the Macy's card. Like when you get all these cards at the store, they sign up for 20% off because they fuel so much of that. And it just feels like that bank would be like, yes, we will take this business. We will let you do things the way you want to do it. But I don't know. Who knows? What do I know? I don't have the Apple Card.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't either. Does anyone here, Abrar, I know you're only a year on the iPhone, but did it? Was your
yeah? We're not that attached to the
surprise. Didn't push you yet to get that?
Just yet, yeah. Give it another
I get
year.
The notifications all the time. 2% cash back.
I've been pretty impressed, actually. I got the iPhone, and immediately I got the card.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they still have the room to win you over, as far as that's concerned. It'll just be with a different bank, I think.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
See right. how long it takes for me to pay there. Yeah.
So let's say
send you an RCS once that's available.
Yeah. Oh yeah, perfect. We'll see if you actually get it.
That's right.
All right, I'm going to take a quick break. Thank the sponsor. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about kind of like the year end kind of replays and stuff, and maybe check in on our Cyber Monday Black Friday kind of histories here and in the past couple of days, see how that fares. So let's take a break and then we'll talk about that stuff. We want to thank ExpressVPN for bringing you this episode of This Week in Tech. I'm a huge fan of ExpressVPN. They are fantastic. It's really the VPN that you can have running all the time if you like. And you just don't notice a difference. Like, so I've used VPNs in the past where, you know, you're using a VPN, everything slows to a crawl. That's not the case with ExpressVPN. And, you know, it is the holiday season. As you're pounding down your potatoes and gravy, don't forget to throw in a little bit of butter in there too. Think about everything you've looked at on your phone in the last few days, every website, every link that you've clicked on. Now, who's in charge of the Wi-Fi you've been enjoying all that content on? Well, guess what? That person has access to everything you've been looking at. Unless you do what I do, you know, if I go to a coffee shop, I use ExpressVPN. It just helps me feel safer. It helps me feel protected. Like I'm not just handing my data over to the coffee shop. ExpressVPN is an app that, yes, I have it on my phone. I have it on my computer. It encrypts all of my online traffic. So whatever, you know, whatever I do, it stays private. By the way, if you think incognito mode is going to save you in this regard, I mean, it's totally misunderstood, right? Incognito mode really makes it seem like you are truly incognito. Think again. Incognito mode does nothing except hide your history from yourself. If you don't have ExpressVPN turned on, you may as well just clink your glass at dinner and read your browsing history out loud to your whole family. Just let them all know. The same goes for wherever you are, work, home, traveling. Are you really going to trust your boss or Airbnb host to respect your privacy? That's what a VPN, a good VPN, is all about. And that's why I've been using ExpressVPN for years, because I value my privacy, and you really should too. That's why we've partnered with ExpressVPN to get you a special holiday offer. Go to expressvpn.com/twit. You can go there right now and you can get 3 extra months of ExpressVPN for free with a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/twit. And check it out for yourself. You're going to be really happy with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN.com/twit to learn more. And we thank them for their continued support of This Week in Tech. Okay, so let's see here. So I'm a Spotify user, and I'm sure I got this somewhere, but so basically, it's the end of the season. It's the end of the year, which means it's the holiday season, which means often about this time, we get these like little end of year wrap ups that show us, you know, what you've been listening to all year, break it out down into like data that you can look at and go, oh, wow, I'm within the top whatever percent of Taylor Swift listeners. I threw that in there for you, Abrar.
Thank you. I figured.
Spotify Wrapped is what it's called. And I have not looked for mine because I realized like my Spotify account is synced in our car for everyone that gets in our car. So mine would be completely useless to me because it wouldn't be a representation of any of the things that I'm listening to. It would be a conglomerate of everything in our family. And that's just, let's just say there's a lot that we all listen to that I would choose not to listen to if I really had you know, the ability to do that. But anyways, any interesting insights from your Spotify Wrapped, Abrar?
So I am one of 5 people who uses YouTube Music. And
oh, okay. Six. I'm another one.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
And the reason I do that is because I already pay for YouTube Premium because I can't stand the ads and I like being able to download before a flight and keeping my, you know, lock screen on if I'm listening to something. And then you get YouTube Music for free. So why pay for another streaming service? To nobody's shock who knows me, Taylor Swift was obviously my number one artist. But I was apparently in the top 0.3% of listeners, which is impressive, except for the fact that no one uses YouTube Music. So my question is, how statistically significant is the stat if no one else is on this platform? But it did tell me I listen more than 39%, more than 39 times what the average listener tunes into Taylor Swift songs for.
Wow.
So, yeah, I think I need a life, but I'm proud. So I'm enjoying her apparently taking over all the streaming services because, you know, for Apple Music, she was highlighted. For Spotify, she was highlighted. It's the year of Taylor, and we're just living in it, really. Yeah,
it has been a big year for Taylor Swift for sure, and in so many different reasons. So I'm not surprised at all. It kind of doesn't matter how many people are on the platform because there are, you know, there are a lot of people on all these platforms, and to be in the top, you know, whatever percent, like that's a big deal. So I think that's something.
Thank you. I'm going to claim it. I'm just going to hold on to
there
it.
You go. Yeah, claim it. I was with YouTube Music for a long time, and eventually. I don't know. Eventually, I just got really annoyed with it for a number of reasons. At this point, I'm removed enough that it's hard for me to remember exactly what annoyed me about it. But the organization of things, I don't know. At a certain point, I relented and went to Spotify. But Tim, you're still with YouTube Music. Did you get this report? Are any interesting nuggets for you, Mew?
I'm actually just trying to pull it up now because I don't think I actually looked at it. Yes, I've been on YouTube Music for quite a while now. I actually got to the point on Spotify where I had enough songs that I'd added to my personal libraries and playlists that Spotify said no more. And that was, wow. It was like I hit the ceiling and there was no warning that I was getting to that ceiling and there were no tools available to let me go through and like, you know, mass delete songs from earlier playlists or that kind of thing. And it's this kind of unwritten cap that not a lot of people get to, but when you do get to it, suddenly Spotify becomes unusable for you because you can't, you know, save your favorites anymore. You can't do any of that stuff. You can't add downloads. You can't do anything. And so I had to basically go through and manually delete things. And it just got to be such a headache that I said, no, I'm done. So I switched over to, YouTube Music probably 4 or 5 years ago. And yeah, same with you, bro. I'm on, it's great to have YouTube Red or Plus or whatever they call it these days to be able to get, commercial free and download and things like that too, which is great. So look at my recap now. And it is actually pretty underwhelming because I have this playlist of like ambient trip hop that I listen to when I write, like Philip Brazilla and, Kruder and Dorfmeister and that kind of stuff from the late '90s. And I've listened to that playlist consistently since the late '90s, I guess. It's just kind of my go ahead and get to work, playlist. And so that always dominates everything all the time. And it's a little bit disappointing because it doesn't include any of the other stuff that I've been listening to through the course of the year. And that's a little bit unfortunate. So, no major surprises from my recap. I'm sorry to say.
I saw someone on TikTok who had like the sound of a fan was their number one.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what they play in the background.
That's awesome.
So
right. Reminds too.
Okay. I'm in that same boat with you, Tim. I listen to a band. I listen to basically like sort of like house instrumental or focus music a lot. And so, of course, that always dominates like what they're trying to serve up. But I do have a tip. If you're a Spotify user, you can go to the playlist and those three little dots. And I just learned about this. You could say exclude from your taste profile.
Oh, nice.
And so if you're listening to a playlist over and over, you know, like your kids bop or something like that, you just exclude it and it will not take that into consideration. And so it really does help. I did that with all my kind of instrumental stuff. I don't know. YouTube Music may have that similar feature.
Yeah,
I'm not
sure. I don't know.
But I also, my other thing is that I wish, and Tim, you kind of alluded to this, these music services, they need a master reset button where you can just say, you know what? I listened to Taylor Swift. I loved her for 3 years and now I want to start fresh and just go into settings and just boom, everything starts fresh. Like you just signed up because why should you have to switch services if, you know, you listened to something a lot that you didn't like or you made all these playlists, like just give me a reset button, which I don't understand what the reasoning is behind that. Maybe they want to keep you in that stickiness of like, you know, you have this stuff that you've built up for many years. I don't know. Anyway, I just started using Spotify probably 6 or 8 months ago. And I will say I was using Apple Music before that because I have that bundled with my Apple One and I have YouTube Music bundled with my YouTube. And neither of those work for me because YouTube doesn't work in my car. And the Apple Music, I really, it's like Spotify is infinitely better. And I didn't realize that to the extent until I switched to it, sadly, because I get Apple Music kind of for free with my bundle.
Right. I mean, one of the best things about the YouTube Music thing is that ad-free YouTube that goes along
definitely.
With it. And that was a big loss for me when we moved to Spotify, suddenly having ads on YouTube. And I never had ads on YouTube. And then to suddenly be presented with not just ads on YouTube. I mean, they are everywhere. They are.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of ads.
I've been a subscriber of Red since day one back, I think it was called YouTube Red when it started.
Yeah. Right.
Now it's premium, I think, but
I mean, it's had to, like,
you don't realize
at this
like,
point.
Yeah. Ads are insane. I mean, it's like even in the scrolling list of stuff, like there's ads. And my kids, I only know because my kids log out of their YouTube because they want to watch stuff that I don't allow them to. So they just log out. And I'm like, why are you watching this with ads? They're like, no reason. I'm
like, uh-huh. And you're in, you caught on to it. Good for you. Also, kids are smart. So.
Oh, yes, yeah. They have found a way around every single parental control I have instituted in this home. It's really, it's pretty wild, actually. It's actually given me a lot of fodder for like social media and stories.
Yeah, I'm sure. And thank you for the tip on the taste profile. I had no idea about this. Was actually, this was earlier this year that they integrated that feature into Spotify. So that completely was not on my radar at all. I will totally use that because my profile is just damaged. Like, it is just completely warped.
That's what I'm saying. You need the reset button so you can just start. Because many of us started this stuff and we didn't like think about it. Like the implications of listening to Tycho every morning, you know, or like instrumental, and like then all of a sudden all your recommendations are like house trance music. And you're like, wait, I don't want this right now.
Right. I like that. And I like it for a very specific thing. I like white noise when I sleep. You know, that doesn't mean that I want to, you know, just because I listen to 8 hours of white noise doesn't mean all I want to listen to are, you know, all different types of noise.
Yeah, or every now and then you go down this like nostalgic rabbit hole where you listen to like, you know, it was like, you know, these bops that just like take you back, and then you're like, I don't want this popping up when I want to listen to today's music that I want to listen to today. Yeah.
It's almost like you need an incognito mode for your Spotify.
Right.
I believe
there is, right?
I wouldn't be surprised. I know that YouTube has something like that, you know, for the same reason, because you don't want it to like, you know, spin off your algorithm in a completely different direction.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
I think it keeps it from your friends. I think because it shares by default maybe to your friends, you know, but maybe I don't think there's one that keeps it from your like actual taste profile for that set amount of time, but it would be a great idea. You know, just
I've heard that it at least prevents it from showing up in your Unwrapped. So at least no one ever has to know.
Yeah.
There you go. You can share your Unwrapped if you want. And exactly. No one will know.
Well, and it's funny because I saw these tweets that were like, you know, Apple Music feels like this is the Apple Music version of Green Bubbles, where like, you know, everyone's on Spotify, and if you're not, then you're the Green Bubble, like you're the outsider. So a little bit of karma for Apple, I guess.
Yeah. You know? TechCrunch wrote about the Apple Music replay and basically said it's no match for Spotify's roundup. Everybody's like trying to replicate the Spotify roundup thing, and apparently Spotify just does it better or something. I don't know if that's because they've been doing it longer or whatever the case may be, but people like data about this sort of stuff. So
surprising.
Yeah, not surprising.
Like, it's like all my data. As long as I can share it on social media and it makes me look cool, take all my data. Yeah.
It's a
careful what you wish for.
I know, right?
These tech companies, believe me,
where that
they will
goes,
run with that.
You don't want to know where that goes, where that leads. No good. And then there's Plex, which this wasn't really an end of year thing, but I felt like it kind of fit into this category. They have a Discover Together feature that apparently they just started rolling out. So it's not a year in review. It's more like a weekly thing where it takes a look at sharing with your friends on Plex what each of you have been watching. The only problem is apparently this is, I think it's opted in by default. And some people are saying that friends' questionable viewing habits are appearing in these emails. And they had no idea because I mean, it's their own server. It's a, you know, it's a Plex server. It's their own media content. Plex says, what did Plex say? They said, if it's indexed on IMDb, then yes, it might appear there, which for certain, you know, risque content apparently is actually the case. So just saying, if you're using Plex, you might want to, you know, well, I think Plex should have done a better job of communicating this, to be honest, because this is the sort of thing that, you know, as a customer is going to turn people off on a service like this because it, you know, it kind of breaks that barrier of trust, but, you know.
Well, yeah, and we were talking earlier about, you know, tech companies rolling out features, you know, having a name drop feature added to your phone is different than having your watch history broadcast to all your friends. Like, there are certain things where you're like, maybe we should give people a heads up or ask them to opt into something that's this major.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So Plex getting a little bit of heat for that. And I think it's probably warranted. Probably should have been an opt-in instead of an opt-out. What else do we got? Oh, okay. So, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. I don't think on last Sunday's show, even though it was after Black Friday, I'm not sure that everybody on that panel actually talked very much about Black Friday. And then we had, of course, Cyber Monday. Apparently there were records this time around. Black Friday, buying hit a record $9.8 billion in the U.S., $70.9 billion globally. And then Cyber Monday, let's see here, according to Adobe Analytics,
like grew $12.4 billion.
Yeah, $12.4 billion, growing 9.6% over the previous year. So, yeah, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, that train is rolling right now. What does that say about, God, if we had to look at like what that says about the economy right now? Because I feel like there's a lot of apprehension right now about kind of where we're heading on the economic front. Is there a recession looming? Yet shopping trends here do not seem to point to the fact that people are overly concerned. They're willing to spend record amounts of money ahead of the holidays. That seems a little kind of counter to me. I don't know. Would you agree?
I've been trying to understand why that is too, because that's all we've been hearing is this looming recession. And, honestly, I feel like the deals this time around weren't that great. I mean, they were okay, but I feel like I didn't really, like, I never saw anything that was, like, that great of a deal. Even on Cyber Monday on Amazon, I saw things that were, like, maybe 20% off. Like, I don't know. It just wasn't as big, or maybe just what I was looking for. But I do want to look into more of why that is. There must be some sort of psychological explanation for what leads people to maybe it's this idea of, okay, well, if I want to buy something and I need it, I need to get it at a discount. So I need to buy it now.
Right.
And because there's this looming recession, because I need to be more careful with my money. And so maybe it's the idea of stocking up now and then not purchasing as much throughout the rest of the year. That's the only thing that I could potentially think of.
Yeah.
Where's this looming recession? Because I have not seen any indicators of it in Los Angeles whatsoever. Every restaurant I go to is completely packed. Every event, Taylor Swift sold out, you know, 9 nights here in LA. Every concert, you know, we just went on Friday night to another concert. I mean, it's just, we keep hearing about this, but in reality, I'm not seeing prices just keep going up and up and people keep seeming to pay these prices. I think when it comes to Cyber Monday and Black Friday, people do buy stuff, and I think those are shopping events, and you know that your stuff is going to be the cheapest on that day, whether it is or not. It's a great day to buy. And so maybe on the flip side, and just kind of thinking about, you know, if there is a recession looming or if there is people pulling back on stuff, maybe they did just choose to shop on those days because they knew they were a better deal. So maybe we don't have the numbers for last Friday and the Friday before and the Friday before that, and maybe they've been horrible. But because it's Cyber Monday and Black Friday, the numbers are up. But this is all very confusing to me as well, because all I hear about is this horrible recession and this and that. And yet somehow it seems like people just continue to spend. And I don't know where it's all coming from.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because we were trapped inside for 2.5 years with lockdowns. And then we got out. And so we're like, we're ready to spend the money. We're ready to go to the concerts. We're ready to go to the events. And then we're also being told about this looming recession. So it's just kind of trying to balance those things out. And then the other piece of the puzzle here is Black Friday is it's no longer just a one-time event, right? So Amazon has these like deals all the time. They're Prime Day deals, and then they're fall Prime Day deals. And then when they do something, Target does something. And when they do something, Best Buy does something, and Walmart. So these companies are constantly having these sales throughout the year. So therefore, Black Friday becomes less of a big deal. Cyber Monday becomes less of a big deal. But we're still spending the money then, because it's ingrained in our minds, right?
So true. Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit on This Week in Google last Wednesday, and how, you know, the old school, but it wasn't really that long ago when the Black Friday experience was getting a circular in the mail that teases a 4 a.m. or a 5 a.m. opening of a particular brick and mortar store, going there and, you know, bum rushing through the door, you know, against hundreds of other people trying to get that TV that is 80% discounted. And the experience now is very different, right? Like, you don't go on Amazon on Black Friday and find an 80% discounted TV, but you find a lot of 20% off things. And I don't know what that even alludes to. I don't know the question around that. It's just, it's interesting how things have shifted, that the definition of Black Friday no longer is doorbusters. It's just everybody has a sale. And then at the end of the day, as a consumer, we have to do our homework, or at least hopefully you are doing your homework, to see, like, is that actually a sale? You know, like, I use Camel on a Black Friday to go on Amazon. You know, if I find something on Amazon, I'll run that, you know, put that link into Camel to see, like, all right, so for over the last 2 years, what has been the pricing history of this thing via Amazon? And sometimes that'll really save you and be like, oh, this is the price it always is. So they did the thing where they, like, jacked the price, and then it's discounted 20% to get it back down to that point. You just have to be a smarter, I guess, consumer, you know, using the tools that you have.
Yeah, and not to quote TikTok again, because this is my source of information these days, but there was a video I saw. Promise I'm a real journalist. There was a video I saw where somebody was at Target and they removed the Black Friday tags from each item, and behind that price tag was another sale tag with the exact same price, and they did it over and over.
Oh my goodness, no.
So it's just like, you do a little bit of digging and you find it. And I feel like that's the modern day equivalent of those doorbusters, because yes, doorbusters were a thing where you could get like a $200 TV or whatever crazy number, but there would be like four of them and you'd have to camp out to get it. And then this is kind of like the equivalent where it's like, okay, you're not getting that, but you are getting situations where you're not getting the deal that you thought you were getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the whole point of the doorbuster was to get you in for the TV that was $199. The first 10 people would get that. And now you're in the store at 4 a.m. and you go, well, I'll get this TV over here that's, you know, $500 or $300, whatever. I mean, it was all part of just getting you into that store. One thing that I find, and I know Camel is great for Amazon. The thing that I really find is that Honey drop list, like, you know, that PayPal Honey thing, you know, whatever. I just, you know, like, everything I just add to that list. And like, when I get that alert from Honey that says like this price dropped, it's like, they're pretty good at like finding when it drops, and it may or may not be over Black Friday, Cyber Monday, but like there are sales from time to time. But I find like the way I shop and consume is like, I'm almost always waiting for like some sort of alert that my price went down, because I'm just like, refuse to just pay the going rate, like that this thing is being sold for like every day, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, it's just,
I haven't used that tool that way. I'll have to take a look. So basically you're going in there and you're saying, these are the things that I'm looking for. And what, you set like a price barrier to say anything below this
not
price
even
I'm interested
no.
in? Or?
You can add things to your Honey list, or if you add anything to your Amazon list, it will follow those items as well.
Oh,
so
okay.
it can do that, but it can do across a variety of stores. And quite honestly, like, Amazon is always the leader when it comes to like the price drops most of the time. But you know, the Targets of the world and the Walmarts of the world, they sort of follow. I mean, everyone is like in line, you know, it's like, if you can't get it there, you get it there. But now Google is doing, you know, with Chrome, they're really getting aggressive into these price alerts too. I've noticed with that little alert button up at the top of the address bar, when you go to a page of a product, it'll now pop up and it'll say, do you want us to track the price of that product? So
I haven't seen
clearly
that.
Yeah. It's like, it's just, it's not like perfect. Like, sometimes it's very prominent, other times it's not. But if you go to like a Best Buy page, it should pop up and you'll see like a little next to the share icon in Chrome, it'll show you like a price tracking icon. And of course, I think Google's end game is to get you to track these prices, but they also will get a little cut of that affiliate, you know, transaction. But that's the whole name of the game of everything these days, right?
Right. Yeah.
There's a similar service in Edge as well that'll also give you price tracking, which I actually found to be quite accurate and quite useful during Black Friday. It also will plug in coupon codes for you automatically, so it's got kind of a bit of a coupon code tracker built in there too, which is nice. So I found that pretty useful. I thought the most interesting thing coming out of Black Friday was how foot traffic had increased a little bit, but you know, I was watching stuff on TikTok too, and I saw a lot of recaps of, you know, people walking through Best Buy on Black Friday morning and the store just being basically empty, which I thought was fascinating. I guess foot traffic was up a couple of percentage points over the year before, but it's still way down from pre-pandemic levels. So we're probably talking 15 to 20% down over, you know, its peaks in 2018, 2019, something like that. So it's interesting to see how that trend has shifted online. I mean, I think, you know, it's a pretty predictable and understandable thing, but it is interesting, you know, when we were thinking about those doorbuster deals that you both were referencing, and the idea that those things are now relics of the past, and just how kind of sleepy it was on Black Friday morning at all these former major retailers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. Before we move on and take a break, did any of you get anything you're particularly happy about that's just for you? I mean, I mentioned on This Week in Google on Wednesday that I got a dish drainer and I got mocked.
No, it's the little things, honestly.
I bought soap. So I bought like 15 bars of soap because they were on sale on that day.
There we go. All right. Dish drainers and soap.
All right. Well, that's how boring it's become, right?
Right.
Back in the day at Best Buy, remember they used to do like the doorbusters with like an SD card or something, you know, it wasn't even micro SD. It was literally like an SD card for like the best price of the year.
Or compact flash even before that.
Yes.
I bought some pinball accessories that I've been waiting to buy. Like you're saying, abroad, the same kind of thing, basically waiting for the right time. And yeah, I knew I needed a whole list of things and I knew there was going to be a sale. So I just kept a big old list. And then when the Black Friday / Cyber Monday coupon code came through my inbox, and I just went and pulled the trigger.
So perfect.
That was probably my most exciting thing, I think.
No, you definitely beat them. It's a low bar. you definitely got a much.
Hey, it's a really nice dish drainer. Okay.
Jeez. I believe it. I got a Kindle because I didn't have one before. I don't know how I've held off for this long, but I've been really loving it. It's been
nice.
Fun.
Kindles are great.
Take it on the train. It's easy, lightweight. So I have now entered the year 2005 at this point. I don't know when did it come out. I don't know how far behind I am. But
does it still have a micro USB? If it has USB-C, you're ahead of the
curve. You're doing
okay. I think it's a USB-C. I haven't charged it yet, but if it is a micro USB, I will throw it out the window.
No, they switched, I think, like last year or the year before. But it was like it took a while for Amazon to like switch to anything but micro USB for the Kindle. It was so frustrating.
That's really annoying.
All right. At least one of us got some technology on Black Friday or Cyber Monday. So thank you for pulling that one through.
My blood.
Let's take a quick break. And then, Tim, you mentioned pinball. I really want to talk to you because about this. After the break, we'll talk about a little bit about pinball because I learned something new about you today. I don't know how I overlooked this over the years, but apparently you renovate and restore pinball machines. And I'm floored by how much work and effort that takes. So let's talk about that after the break. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode of This Week in Tech, brought to you by Lookout. Business has changed forever. Boundaries to where we work, to where we do our work, or even how we work where we are, those have all disappeared. That means your data is always on the move, whether you're on a device or maybe you're doing your business in the cloud, across networks, at a local coffee shop. While that's great for your workforce, it's a big challenge for IT security, right? Keeping up with all those different variables. Lookout helps you control your data and free your workforce. With Lookout, you're going to gain complete visibility into all your data so you can minimize risk from external and internal threats. Plus, you can ensure compliance. By seamlessly securing hybrid work, your organization doesn't have to sacrifice productivity for security. And Lookout makes IT security a lot simpler, too. Working with multiple point solutions and legacy tools in today's environment, it's just too complex, right? With its single unified platform, Lookout reduces IT complexity, giving you more time to focus on whatever else comes your way. Good data protection isn't a cage. It's a springboard, letting you and your organization bound toward a future of your making. Visit lookout.com. Do that today and learn how to safeguard data, secure hybrid work, and reduce IT complexity. That's lookout.com. We thank Lookout for their support of This Week in Tech. And speaking of Twit, we had a wonderful week this week. Leo's been out all week. He comes back this next week. But this preview, looking back anyways, is full of moments that you may have missed.
Pick of the week. It is a really cool game that is set in 16th century Bavaria, and related to the dawn of the printing press.
Oh my God.
Is all wood. You'd love it, Jeff.
You can report back on its historical accuracy.
I want to get on stage at Gutenberg the Musical so I can say exactly how everything in the musical is wrong.
I think that would go over really well.
I think so, too.
Previously on Twit. iOS Today.
Apparently, on Facebook, people were suggesting that name drop was incredibly dangerous.
Both people have to agree to share their information, and then a little animation pops up, and ta-da, it will then, at that point, share your contact information. But it doesn't just magically do it when you touch two phones together. This is not the privacy threat that people are reporting that it is.
This Week in Space.
We're joined by Dr. George Neal. You are a spaceman. Not many people get to say that.
The whole experience was an incredible one. After liftoff, you're pushed back into your seat. Photographs and videos just do not do it justice. Just an incredible view.
This Week in Google.
Adobe's $20 billion purchase of Figma would harm innovation. UK regulators provisionally fined. A merger can bring a better product to the masses. I don't see anything wrong with that. And again, I think it's one of those lines of, well, if we can't beat them, let's buy them.
Well, but that's, I think you've just made the antitrust argument.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Figma's like, sure.
Twit.
Our routing number is here.
Of course.
Yeah, cash in. Cash in. Let's see here. First of all, I just want to say Tim Stevens, Abrar Al-Hiti, Rich DeMuro, thank you so much for doing this. This has been a lot of fun hanging out with you guys, and it's been a nice little CNET past and present reunion of sorts. So it's been fun talking tech with you guys. Tim, I came across, I think it was a Threads post of yours as we were kind of leading up to today of the Williams Comet pinball machine. And then I realized in that moment, like, wait a minute, this is an aspect of Tim Stevens that I was not aware of. So I don't know how I missed it over the last couple of years, but you renovate old pinball machines. And as I started kind of looking through pictures, and then you shared a cool article you wrote, a very detailed article you wrote about the experience of rebuilding one machine, I am just so impressed, not just that you do this, but anybody does this, because this looks as rewarding as it probably is. It looks like a total nightmare to me, like a stress ball. Like I would pop one of these things open and in 10 minutes be completely lost and never be able to get it back together again. So I'm impressed that you can even pull that off. Tell us a little bit about what that's like. My goodness.
Yeah, these are incredibly complicated machines. Pinball machines were hugely popular for, decades and decades, and then they very quickly got wiped off the face of the planet in the late 80s and early 90s as arcade machines, video games came in, largely because these pinball machines were so incredibly difficult to keep alive that all these arcade operators were very happy to go to a solid-state video game machine and get all the stupid pinball machines out of their lives. So that's what almost killed pinball tables. It's this hobby that my wife and I have that we've gotten into, where we take old, unloved, really tired and abused pinball machines and strip them down and polish them and bring them back to life. That's the one that you're playing now, is the space shuttle machine that we are just about finishing. We're doing some final work with paint matching on that to get it ready to go, and then that will be up for sale probably pretty soon. But yeah, we take these unloved machines that are covered in dust. The Comet that I was working on today, literally I spent about half an hour this morning sucking up cobwebs and all sorts of nastiness out of that thing to get it ready to be torn down. And then we will basically take off the playfield, strip all the components off of that, sand that down, put on a new playfield, and then we polish up all the components. We will repaint the cabinet. And this one in particular needs a lot of CPU work as well. All the circuit boards have to come out. I'm going to have to pull a lot of components off of that too. But as you can see in that picture there,
Look at that. That is like a nightmare.
Everything's hardwired on a pinball machine. There's no real quick disconnects to make it easy. And so on that table, that high speed table that we refurbished, we did a full playfield swap, which means the plank of wood that everything's attached to, we actually put a new one in. And since everything attaches to that plank of wood, everything has to come off. And that meant desoldering every single one of the hundreds of components that are in there. So I had to label every single connector on there and then desolder them all by hand and then put the new playfield on and solder everything back up again. It took us just about a full year to do that. So that project's working, nights and weekends and that kind of thing, kind of casually.
I aspire for that level of patience and commitment. That is amazing.
100%. You took the words right out of my mouth, Abra.
Yeah.
It's turning into to like this this kind of weird co-op strategy game for my wife and I, where, you know, we enjoyed playing through games like The Witness together and things like that. So when we kind of dove into this, it's this massive exercise of troubleshooting. You know, why is this bulb not coming on? Okay, let's go trace the wire. And then you trace the wire back up to the board. And then is the wire working? If the wire's working, then there's something wrong on the board. And if there's something wrong on the board, then is it this chip? Is it this transistor? And so it's just that times a million, basically. And on top of that, there's aspects of woodworking and painting and refurbishing. And so if you get sick of soldering one day, you can send something down and paint it instead, or do any number of things. And it's just a massive puzzle, basically, to figure out. And we found it to be, it's kind of a nice way, even though it's a bit of technology, it's actually a good way to disconnect from everything, because everything is very tangible. Everything is right in front of you. And it's a great way to kind of get away from everything for a couple hours.
Great way to get it away from everything for a couple of hours. And I think I'm probably correct in saying, like, a really cool, like, way to bond with your partner. Like, you're both, like, focused effort on this one really, like, complex piece of machinery together. Like, what a cool project to do together. I'm so in awe of this.
Yeah, it's been really great. She thought I was absolutely insane when I started to work on my first table. And then she said, well, I'll help you out and do the bulbs. That was what she was going to help me out. Because one of the big things that you do if you're bringing a new table back to life is you replace the old incandescent bulbs with new LED bulbs, which are cooler, more efficient, you know, all the good stuff that come along with LEDs. So she got into, you know, researching what's the ideal color temperature for all these LEDs, and she got totally into that. And then it just went all way downhill from there.
That's like a real act of love right there.
I know, right?
You're interested in this thing.
100%.
I'm gonna join you and I'm going to do the research. I love that.
5 years ago, did either of you think this is going to be our part-time, you know, our off-time hobby together is rebuilding pinball machines? Like, how were you inspired to do that in the beginning?
No, it definitely was not meant to be a hobby. Basically, we refurbished our garage, and we turned it from kind of a scary, dark, and dingy place into a nice place that we actually wanted to do work in. We, you know, did drywall and paint and turned it into a nice place, because we both like working on cars, and she has her wood shop out there. And the cherry on top for me was going to be to get this high-speed pinball table, which was always my favorite table as a kid. I never had the money to play it, but I always watched all the other kids who played, and I finally had the opportunity. Now I had the perfect corner in my garage set. I was going to get this table, and I got it and put it in the corner and loved it. And then I immediately realized that I had room for a second pinball table next to it. And we decided that the table we wanted was Star Trek The Next Generation. We both love Star Trek The Next Generation, and this is a really great pinball table, but it's also a very valuable pinball table, and it was a little more than I wanted to spend. So I found a very tired, very cheap one, and I said, I'm going to buy this beat-up old table, and I'm going to bring it back to life. And my wife thought I was absolutely insane. But it turned out to be the kind of the beginning of this great hobby for the two of us.
Well, I'm deeply respect what you're doing here, and God, that'll keep you busy for a while. That table full of wires going all over the place. Like, you know what it reminds me of? It makes me realize, like, before my wife and I just upgraded to a laser printer not too long ago, because the previous printer that we had was an inkjet, and, you know, we got it because it was a well-rated inkjet. Well, sure enough, somewhere along the line, it started acting weird, as all inkjet printers seem to do. And I didn't want to just, you know, do the lazy thing of, like, throw it away or give it away or whatever. I wanted to, like, open it up and, like, see, like, okay, there's got to be a deeper way to clean these things so that we can get some more life out of this. Because it breaks my heart to think that I'm buying this gigantic mass of technology and I'm going to use it for 4 years and then it's going to end up in a landfill. Like, I'm just not okay with that. And so I broke it open and, you know, found some tutorials online, some videos and everything. And it seemed to me that it was way more complicated and difficult for me than it probably would be for other technology minded people, but I was able to figure it out. Flash forward another, like, maybe 9 months, and the printer's doing the same thing again. And so I end up popping that sucker open and trying to, like, piece it back together, which was maybe, like, I don't know, 7 wires total, you know, and, like, a little ribbon and stuff like that. Like, it was pretty obvious where things go. was so hard for me, and maybe it's just how my brain works. So then I look at this table with like literal hundreds of connections on all this wire going everywhere. I was just like, that does not work for my brain. Yeah. I could not do that. I'm pretty certain I could not do that. Maybe I could do it if I was there with someone doing it, but by myself.
You could definitely do it, yeah. I mean, I knew nothing at all about this. I just jumped in, and so, you know, I didn't know how to read a multimeter before that. I really knew very basic soldering, but now, you know, I'm pretty proficient at doing that kind of thing. I can read a wiring diagram, which is really, really important as you're doing this kind of thing. And yeah, it's just stuff that we picked up along the way. It's just kind of a non-passion for us, but yeah, we felt the same way. I mean, it feels really good to take something that is absolutely awful and ugly and full of dirt and bugs and cobwebs. And at the, you know, a couple of months later or a year later, in some cases, you have this beautiful shiny pinball table that looks as good as new. And then you can get to play it, which is the best part. You know, at the end you have this cool thing that we can play for a while and then send it off to a new home, hopefully.
Yeah. Well, really cool stuff. I love that. That's what you do in your off time. One of the things that you do.
One of the things, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then finally, before we wrap things up, any KISS fans here? Anyone into that old, aging 50 years ago KISS band? No, apparently not.
You know, the first pinball table I ever played was a KISS pinball table.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
Moving here, but no, I can't say I'm a big KISS fan.
I mean, I appreciate some of their music, but I wouldn't say that I'm a diehard KISS fan. Anyways, why am I talking about KISS? Well, they, on Saturday night, that was just yesterday, had their final performance of their End of the Road farewell tour. This was in New York City's Madison Square Garden. So apparently KISS is no longer. Why are we talking about this on a technology show? Because KISS is going to be immortalized as they become digital avatars. And basically, the avatars are created by George Lucas's special effects company, of course, Pop House Entertainment Group, a collective that was responsible for ABBA's virtual concert, which I checked the prices on this virtual concert, and they're like, this is a pricey thing that happens, you know, that is going all the time. And I don't know if KISS's virtual show is going to be a touring show or if it's going to be a fixture, but it's just interesting to me that we're at the point where, you know, even when a band members age out, they can create an enduring experience of their show that's based on them. And I don't know if you, Benito, have the link to the ABBA virtual concert, but there's a video in there, a video player in there. If you hit play on this and then just, you know, imagine that it's KISS, but it's also ABBA. Like, if this was the first time that, like, I watched a video like this and I was like, okay, I've heard about virtual avatars doing, you know, shows like during someone's show, they bring up, you know, like Michael Jackson or something like that. It always sounded really cheesy to me, and it still kind of does. But if you're in an environment like this where it's really set up for that experience, I can see this actually being really cool. Like, this would be a really interesting way to, you know, keep the dream alive, keep the KISS alive. What do you all think? Is this cheese or cool?
You know, obviously my first reaction is to think, why would I want this? But then I think about myself and the fact that I go to these like Taylor Swift nights where they just play her music. And I remember the first time I told like my sister that I was going to one of these, she was like, so you got dressed up, went somewhere, were really excited about it, took all these pictures, posted them on social media, and Taylor wasn't even there. Like, and so when I went to the actual Taylor Swift concert, she was like, will Taylor actually be there this time? Because she sees how excited I get for things where it's like the artist isn't actually even there. So imagine if there's this virtual projection of the artist that you love and know. And like, you see this with the Taylor Swift concert movie, for example, like people are in the theater, like dancing and having a good time. Yeah. And that's just like a normal movie theater screen. So if it's something immersive like this, of course, nothing will replace being able to see the person live on stage, but not everyone has that opportunity. And as artists get older and they can't do that, then this could be, you know, a logical replacement for that.
Well, when
I totally agree. Yeah.
Sorry, Tim, go.
I think, yeah, sorry about that. No. I also think it's probably, if in some ways, a less depressing thing than seeing, you know, the same band that's been on tour for 30 years and just getting progressively slower and maybe a little bit more off tune each time. To see a band in their prime, even in a digital way, might be a more satisfying thing to do. And, you know, there are a lot of bands that I listen to that I'll never have the chance to ever see live. And so it would be interesting to be able to have that experience, even if it were a virtual experience. But yeah, I'm not sure that it should cost as much as a real experience. And so, yeah, so I think I agree with you there, Jason. I'm surprised at how much these things cost.
Yeah,
I think that was going to be my comment. Is it's cool, and I think that it's kind of fun, but there's got to be a limit for me for the price that I'm willing to pay. And I think with the Taylor Swift thing, like, we saw that movie and it was very popular, but the price point was very good for a lot of people. And it's local, it's easy. So I do see this as like really fun, and like, why not? Like, you can see a lot of different, it's like another form of entertainment. And so it is kind of cool, but I think the prices of concert tickets are very expensive. These should be like a fraction of the price, you know? And then you make it up on the beer price, I guess.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, exactly. The price is really, really high for the ABBA experience. I think it was something like in the 150 range or something. And I don't know. But then at the same time, if you're in a room like that video, they're obviously in an auditorium that is designed for that. So there's a whole light show that's surrounding them. It's a very immersive environment. I think also in that situation, you need a room full of people, because if it's just like 10 of you there, maybe not nearly as exciting, you know.
I think on a similar side to this, I tested a virtual concert experience, but it wasn't really a concert. It was like one person performing almost like a private show for you, like in VR. I'm trying to remember the artist's name, but it was really interesting because it was very well done, super high production value. Oh, Zara Larsson, and it's this company called Amaze VR. And it was really impressive. I mean, just sitting there, it was like a 15, 20 minute show, but it was like almost like it made me realize that will be another form of entertainment where you will pay, you know, $20 to watch a VR concert that is for you. It seems personalized for you. And of course, you'll be able to watch concerts that are also in VR. So I think there's just so much entertainment just continues to evolve. And there, you know, being in that concert hall with, you know, when I went to see Taylor Swift, it was like 70,000 people. And, you know, we are so high up. And like, what are you doing 99% of the time? You're looking at that screen that has them on. You're watching TV inside a shared venue.
Yeah.
And unless you're in front row, second row, whatever, that's kind of the concert going experience these days. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's a lot at play here, and a lot of potential for technology to change the way we see entertainment, but also not get rid of the traditional concert, but just, you know, different ways of experiencing that.
Yeah.
And those conversations have really ramped up post lockdowns, because there was a virtual concert, and I think it's a very generous term, but somebody at CES during that one year that we were all locked down, it was 2021, had a virtual concert experience that I attended. And it was you're just like on your computer, and it's like there's little dots everywhere, and then that like the performer's on this little screen on your computer. It was trying too hard, I think. And I was like, I don't know why I would ever want this. If you're watching in VR, that sounds a lot cooler. But I think there have been all these conversations about what does that concert going experience look like with this obvious shift that we've had in terms of how we work and how we communicate with people when we've realized that sometimes we just want to stay home.
Yep.
I think most of the time I would like to stay home.
Yeah, yeah. I don't leave that couch. Yeah.
Except when you are invited as a guest on This Week in Tech.
Then you don't have to leave home. That's the best part.
Yeah, exactly.
You're still not leaving home. It's the best guest ever.
Why we're here, yeah.
Yeah. Well, next time we'll have to have the three of you in the studio, and you will leave home. No, it's okay. Yes. We can always do this long distance. It's fine, too.
For you, Jason.
Yeah, anything.
Thank you. I'm honored. Seriously, thank you to all of you for being on today. Abrar Ahiti with CNET. It's just a real pleasure to be able to do this show with you now, not just TNW, but Twitch. So thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. Always such a pleasure.
Yeah. And people can find your the videos that you produce. You also write articles. So you do a little bit of both for CNET, right?
I do. So I'm on CNET's website, CNET socials. You'll see my face everywhere. Follow along. Hopefully you'll find it useful.
Yes, indeed. Well, I do. Thank you, Abrar. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
And Tim Stevens, timstevens.substack.com, doing the independent thing. Tim, it's a pleasure. I always enjoy getting the chance to catch up with you. So thank you for hanging out today.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll have you back again soon. And I'm sure you'll tell us about the Cybertruck once you get your own. Maybe you won't get your own, but you haven't driven in one yet, right?
I've not. I've been driven in one, but I've not had a chance to
drive one yet. Okay, so you've been inside it. Was it at least comfortable on the inside?
It was fine. Yeah, I mean, it certainly wasn't up there with like a Lariat Trim F-150 or anything like that, but it was roomy and spacious anyway.
Okay. Well, at least there's that then. All right. Thank you, Tim. And Rich DeMuro at KTLA, of course, Morning News, and Rich on Tech, Rich on Tech TV. Rich, thank you so much. Always fun hanging out with you. Occasionally, I get to run into you in real life at a Google event, which happened earlier this year, but this is second to that. So thank you.
That's right. Thank you for having me, and find my podcast. The radio show is Rich on Tech, but that's also the name of the podcast. So subscribe and see what all the fun is on that show.
That's it. And that's at richontech.tv?
Yeah, or just search in your favorite, audio app. That's what I say nowadays.
That's what a lot of people
I mean, you can find the direct link, but let's be honest, whatever you use. I've been using Spotify for podcasts, and I think it's actually been pretty good.
There you go. Wherever you are, there you are. Just use that. All right. Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it. Thank you to Benito. Thank you to John Slanina here in the studio for helping us do this show today. Thank you to Leo for allowing me to sit in his chair, although I'm not actually in the Dr. Evil chair. I find that chair to be just a little too big and spacious. So I'm in a normal chair, but nonetheless, I'm in the center of the table hosting an episode of TWiT. And I can't thank Leo and Lisa enough for the opportunity to do that. And thank you for allowing me to kind of sit in his place. Leo will be back for next week's episode of TWiT. In the meantime, if you want to find all of our past episodes, all the information about what we do here on this show, just go to twit.tv/TWiT. And you'll have your information right there. We record every Sunday starting at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. And yeah, everything you need to know is there. Don't forget, we also have a club called Club TWiT. This is a way for you to subscribe to the content that we do directly. And right now, podcast advertising, it's in a really challenging place right now. And so we are just incredibly thankful to have the club as an opportunity. And for those of you who are willing to, pay a monthly fee for our content, get all of our shows with no ads, get extra content, extra shows that don't exist outside of the club, as well as access to our Discord, which is just a whole lot of fun. All that for $7 a month. twit.tv/clubtwit is where you can go for that. And you're supporting us directly, and we really, really, really thank you when you do that. But as for me, find me at raygun.fun. That's my shortened URL for a direct link to all the things that I have going on online. It's just easier than telling you all the different places I am. Raygun.fun and Tech News Weekly as well, every Thursday with Micah Sargent, and AI Inside every Thursday in the club with Jeff Jarvis. But that's it. I'm going to end the show right now. Thank you so much for watching and listening to This Week in Tech. Another TWiT is in the can. Bye, everybody. Amazing.